It is now. Okay, I want to welcome everybody to the meeting of the Marine Interest Group of San Luis Obispo County. My name is Don Maruska. I'm the independent facilitator for the group. And we're delighted to have this special session tonight to really focus in on what's happening in the scientific community. What's the collaboration that's occurring between the scientists and the fishermen and the environmentalists and others to help understand the marine resources off the coast and what can be done to enhance and sustain them. So this is an exciting evening. It's packed with a lot of things. We're going to take an abbreviated portion of this time to go over the first item on the agenda, which is to give each of the members just a moment to make a quick comment here about any particular news or updates that they want to offer. And if some of you have someone who is an alternate of yours who's coming for the first time this evening, I'd like you to introduce them just so that the rest of the members can get to know them in the event that they show up at a subsequent meeting to fill in for you. So let's just begin and go around. Ray, would you start?
Sure. I don't have anything to add.
Just have to speak into the mic.
My name is Dave Sears, and I have but one comment, and that is to introduce my alternate, Kirk Sturm. How about standing up, Kirk? Kirk's a retiree from State Parks and is going to do very well alternating with me in this capacity, so please welcome him.
Okay, good. Now, I'd also like to make a comment about Kirk, and that is that he was a deputy director of State Parks. And is known to this area because of his involvement in working with all many constituencies here around the Hearst Castle and other things in this coastal area. Kirk has also been asked by the Marine Life Protection Act effort to be a local contact and representative and somebody to help organize local stakeholder sessions and to be a conduit of information back and forth. And Kirk, if you just come up and introduce yourself a little bit and talk for a moment about that role, because this group has a lot of interest in the Marine Life Protection Act. I think they'd like to know a little more about your role in that, just briefly.
Thank you. Don, first of all, thanks for inviting me. I just found out a couple of days ago about my new role in helping out. Actually, there's a lot that I don't know right now, Don. I don't know exactly what my working title is, other than the outcomes or the process for me is to be local in the community, to be community outreach, to make sure everybody's input is heard. There's a famous decision-making process, and step one is everybody included? So my goal is to go from the Guadalupe area up to Cambria and make sure everybody's included. That's about it so far.
Okay.
Could you give us contact information on how we could contact you?
Yes. Right now, let's use 528-9518.
And the Marine Life Protection Act initiative has an email distribution list, and if you have an interest in that, go to their website and get on that email distribution list, and I'm sure when you get formally set up, Kirk, they'll send out an email to let people know all the different ways to get a hold of Kirk and participate in that endeavor. They're just getting going on the local setup, so might be a little while before that happens, but I think that'll be occurring soon. Okay. Thank you.
I guess it's me.
PJ.
PJ Webb. I am the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council at Large representative, and that's my role here. I apologize for missing the last meeting. I do not have an alternate as yet, but I'm still working on that. The one piece of announcement I wanted to advise people of is that the August meeting of the Sanctuary Advisory Council will be in Cambria, and that's a good opportunity. It'll be the first Friday in Cambria in August. It's a great opportunity to come to the public comment session and give your comments to the Sanctuary Advisory Council. If there's a particular issue you want addressed, or if you want to put forth some information, it's a good way to be heard. Also, if anybody wants an agenda, they're on the web for the agenda. You're not going to have the August agenda yet, but if you want me to email you an agenda, just let me know. Thank you.
Jeremiah?
Good afternoon. Jeremiah O'Brien. representative for the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization. And I guess since last time, we had our annual blessing of the fleet last week, and we served about 200 people, I believe, at the blessing. We also, at that time, were able to give a $3,000 donation to the Morro Bay Library, and would encourage anyone listening to do what they can for the library also. The blessing isn't, we don't publicize it, but it's open to anyone for future reference. We do it every April, just before salmon season begins. And it's open to everyone, and we had a barbecue at the Veterans Hall immediately after the blessing, which took place at the T Pier and the Embarcadero. And the barbecue is free to anyone who wishes to attend. As I say, we fed about 200 people. I think we probably could have fed another 75, so hopefully we'll see everybody there next year. Thank you.
I'm Marla Morrissey, Conservation Chair for the MIG. And for those of you who missed our Bevan Sustainable Fishing Series that played this afternoon, I was pleasantly surprised. We had, about 12 people that showed up off and on to watch a lecture series from University of Washington about sustainable fishing models. And AGP is going to play that, so the community will have an opportunity, and those of you who didn't make it this afternoon will be able to see it too. If you go online to Bevan Sustainable Fishing, you'll be able to see some of the other speakers, and we hope to get feedback from you about whether you would like to continue to watch this series. So please let us know. And I don't know, Don, maybe you'll talk about that later, but...
Well, why don't we just cover that for just a moment? I think, PJ, you watched most of those videos. Do you have just a comment about what you got from it, just so people might calibrate their interest level in watching it when it replays?
Sure. I found them very interesting. They presented models for both developed countries and developing nations, and different models of how they did quota systems, how the possibility of doing an auction for permits, and different models, and how they actually worked, and what they were finding was successful and what wasn't successful. And I just found it very helpful to see new ways of dealing with fishing and regulation. There was also one speaker in particular whose name I can't pronounce.
I probably can't either.
Who he sort of went over the history of how regulation of fishing in this country grew out of the regulation of BLM lands and grazing and mining law, and how there's a new paradigm that we're going to need to shift how we deal with the concept of how we regulate fisheries to maintain sustainability. I highly recommend. It's hard to watch all of it at one setting because there's a lot of information in there, but there's lots of really good ideas on how to make it something that is economically viable and sustainable.
Okay, thanks. Tom?
I'm Tom Capen. I represent the Port St. Louis Commercial Fishermen's Association, and I have nothing to add other than commercial wild king salmon season will open May 1st, so hopefully there'll be lots of fish available.
My name is Mel DeLamotte. I'm sitting in for Bob Hather. I'm the president of the Central Coast Fisheries Conservation Coalition. Bob asked me to mention sort of an update on some recent developments concerning fishing along the Central Coast for recreational fishermen. We're in the zone called the South Central Zone, which goes from Point Sur to Point Conception. The laws at the beginning of the year provided recreational fishing for 5 months from May 1st to September 30th, and the only fishing was going to be allowed between 20 fathoms and 40 fathoms. Along the Central Coast, that, generally speaking, is about a mile offshore out to around maybe 3 or 4 miles offshore. Steve Moore, who used to be a member of this panel, and I have been lobbying the Director of Fish and Game and the Fish and Game Commission regularly since last summer, trying to get this law changed. Our main complaint was this effectively foreclosed any kayak fishing along the Central Coast. It unfairly prevented any fishing of the kelp beds along the coast because most of them are inside of 20 fathoms. And because of our weather problems along the Central Coast, it made it dangerous for both kayakers and small skiffs when the wind would come up in the afternoon, and it increased danger to fishermen. We lobbied very hard up until the 1st of April about, and finally the Director of Fish and Game agreed to our request and has changed the regulations so that starting this Sunday, when we go recreational rock fishing, we get to fish from shore out to 40 fathoms. The directors also promised that if our quotas come in lower than anticipated in May, June, and July, that they will consider opening up recreational fishing in October, November, December as well. So these are all very beneficial developments in our relationship with Fish and Game.
Okay. Nancy.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Dahlman. I represent Marine Science Education at Cuesta, and I noticed I have 5 whole minutes later in the schedule to talk about the sand crab study, so I'll just wait until that time for my spiel.
I'm Matthew Fleming, the recreation chair and chair of San Luis Bay Surf Rider. So nothing more to add right now. Should I talk about the meeting that we kind of didn't have?
Yeah, why don't you just cover that quickly, just so people know where you are.
Okay, well, the four of us sitting here, we were wondering if that was there was a reason for that, so you could take us all out at once. But we're we are working on setting up some protocol and various methods and criteria for bringing members in and understanding what members, if a member leaves, what should an alternate replace that member immediately, or should it be opened up for applications? So there's a lot of questions about that, and I've gone online and done quite a bit of research on different models. Dan has talked about looking at the model that NEP uses, and we're trying to find the best thing that will fit for the MIG, not just adopting any one wholesale from some other group, but to find something that will best work for what we have here, which is similar to other things like the Sanctuary Advisory Council, but also somewhat different. So that's where we're going, and we'll be meeting here in the next 2 weeks if we can settle a date, and we'll have more to report next time.
Thank you. Dave.
Yeah, Dave Reimel, representing Sport Fishing. Mel pretty much covered everything that I was going to talk about. The only exception is I'd really like to see Sport Fishing opened up about 360 feet like they do below Point Conception. I don't think there's any reason why we can't be fishing out there.
Hi, I'm Dan Berman. I'm the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. And the estuary program is working away on habitat restoration as well as community education outreach projects. We accept grant applications regularly. We award grants for education outreach projects as well as for larger restoration projects. And the next grant application deadline for the estuary program is going to be in early June. You can go to our website, which is mbnep.org, and check out. You can actually get the grant applications there. And then we also have our quarterly implementation committee meeting of the estuary program, which is all the different partners in the estuary program getting together to, like this, talk shop, and then also hear what staff's been up to lately. So that's going to be a week from today, next Thursday, from 12 to 2 in this building, in the smaller room right as you first come in. So welcome everyone there. It's open to the public, and that information is also available on our website. Thanks.
I'm Carolyn Moffat. I'm commissioner at Port San Luis Harbor District, and I'm representing Ports and Harbors on MIG. I'm very excited to advertise that the rock fishing season is opening this coming weekend. It's been closed since the 1st of January, and our leasees are very anxious to welcome you. Please come on down.
I'm Colby Concho-Krotzer, and I have the unfortunate news that Pam Hetherington's mother passed away, and as director of EcoSlo, I'm her substitute tonight. So if you care to have a thought in mind for her.
I'm Henry Pontarelli. I represent the Morro Coast Audubon Society. I'd like to introduce my alternate, Jim Johnson. Jim comes to us from the business community. He's also got some not-for-profit experience, and he's the Morro Coast Audubon's present treasurer. So I'd also like to announce, on July 25th, the Audubon Society is sponsoring a pelagic trip in conjunction with the Cal Poly Pelagic Bird Survey. There's still space available on the boat. There's about 20 spots available on the boat. We've made berths available for the community while the scientific study is going on. We've got three such opportunities this year, two more, one in October and one in July. If you're interested in signing up, you can go to our website, www.morrocoastaudubon.org. Last month or last meeting, I volunteered, or we discussed getting a letter together that we might make available as a letter to the editor or something that would create some positive press or some awareness for the MIG and some factual information for the MIG, how it was formed, what its hopes and dreams are. And I found that to be a little bit more complex than I initially perceived it, and the letter will be finished for your review at the next meeting.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Jim?
Yeah, my name's Jim Wood, representing the City of Morro Bay, and I don't have anything to report other than what's already been reported. I watched the film. It came down for a while. I watched the films that were shown earlier at home. I kind of would like to have seen the question and answer period that the tape stopped at, I guess, 4:30, and there was a question asked and never answered, and I assume there were a number of questions asked, and maybe we could get...
Jim, if you go online, you can see those.
Okay.
They weren't of a quality that would have been able to go on community access TV, and... It's a two-day symposium, so I just pulled the best. But if you want to see the question, they have panels. They were great.
Okay.
And you can actually go online and watch those.
Super. Thanks.
We'll include in the minutes from the notes from tonight's meeting the web address so that you can get that information and go there if you'd like. Dean.
Evening. I'm Dean Wendt, and I am the research chair on the MIG committee. And in terms of updates, today's meeting is really, the whole meeting is about updates of the work that we've been doing. So you'll see plenty of our updates. But I would like to take this time to introduce my alternate, Dr. Lars Tominek. He's joining the faculty at Cal Poly next fall, and he is going to bring a terrific amount of expertise in marine organisms, and he's really going to broaden our expertise at Cal Poly, and I'm very happy that he has agreed to be my alternate, and I even went so far as to invite him so that he can see what this is all about. He has no idea what he's getting into, so be on your best behavior.
Okay.
Anyway, welcome, Lars, and let's just get on with the show.
Okay. And Dean is going to have another update after the collaborative research about what's happening with the ecosystem-based management project. So I want to be sure that you hang in for that update because, as you know, that proposal is going to be due the end of June, and that's coming up very soon. We want people to know where that's headed and what's going on with that and get your input. There is a working group that's contributing to that from this group and from NEP. So that group has all been participating very well and a good representation, but we'd like you all to know about that. Okay, in terms of letters or other communications, I don't have anything that I've received on your behalf. I know that some of you have responded to the invitation from the Marine Life Protection Act initiative to be members of a Central Coast stakeholders group. they decided to pick the area from Pigeon Point to Point Conception as the initial study region to look at what areas within that might be appropriate to have marine protected areas, and if so, what kind. And I think a number of you may have applied. I heard of interest from that. Maybe it'd be of interest to the other members to just sort of see who might have expressed interest in that from this group, so we get a sense of some of the diversity of interest. If you'd like to just indicate if you did, that would be might be of interest to other members to see who came forward. Okay. So
Don, I have a question about that. Since I'm not a regular member, did you make an outreach to let people know about the deadline? Or
yes.
Did the MIG have a position about trying to a lot of people or type of people?
Well, I encourage certainly everybody to apply. Because they're in such a short time frame, actually their announcement and invitation came out between our last meeting and the nominations were due the 25th, this prior Monday. So we didn't have any opportunity for that in particular, and because the MIG is a multi-stakeholder group, they're really looking for people who would represent particular stakeholder interests. And again, that's the sort of thing, if people are interested in the MLPA, I'd encourage you to get on their email distribution list, because things are moving so quickly there that if you're not on that distribution list, it's hard to keep up with what's going on. At least that's been my observation.
Does anyone know who makes the final determination?
From the website, they indicated that the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the Director of Fish and Game.
Thanks.
Okay.
And that is your laser. That's your laser pointer. And then pull down.
Can you all hear me okay? Loud enough? Okay, great. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk a little bit about this developing regional ocean observing system in central and northern California. Our region extends from Point Conception north to the California-Oregon border and from the bays and estuaries of California out to the 200 nautical mile line, the seaward extent of the exclusive economic zone of the United States. And this effort isn't a brand new thing. It's actually a collaboration that's building off of many existing and good programs in the region. So we're not reinventing the wheel, but we're trying to make the best of what we already have. I just wanted to give you a little bit of context for how this regional ocean observing system is developing. It's part of a nationwide effort called the U.S. Integrated Ocean Observing System, or IOOS. And this national effort is being coordinated by a federal interagency office called ocean.us, and that's staffed by people from NOAA and NASA, NSF, and the Navy, among some other federal agencies with oceans in their mandate. And the goals of this observing system, as you can see here, there are 7 of them, and they're very applied-oriented. So this is not an observing system for pure research, per se, although research is a very important foundation for this effort. But we're really trying to fulfill some of the user needs of the different user communities. And it ranges everything from trying to detect and forecast the oceanic components of climate variability, to ensuring national security, and also to ensure public health. So there are a large diversity of uses that the system can be applied to, and I think many of these are relevant to the work of this group, as from what I've seen on many of your documents on the website. There are basically 2 components to this nationwide system. There's a global component, which feeds into an even bigger global effort involving many different countries. And then there's also the coastal effort, which is focused on the waters of the United States. And that coastal component is further broken down into 2 parts. There's a consistent national backbone around the whole coast of the United States. And this backbone includes a standard suite of platforms and sensors that provide information on a standard set of variables. And I'll show you a listing of those variables in a minute.
Could I ask
ask you to use the microphone, please? We're picking up a lot of noise in the room.
Okay. I have one on, but I guess it's not picking up. Last time I wore one of these, it picked up my heartbeat, so
I want to get
that.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. And to complement this national backbone, there are regional associations developing around the country. There are 11 of them, and they're to focus more on the coastal inputs to the coastal waters, so land-based inputs, to focus more on biological and chemical variables, and to provide information on a greater spatial and temporal resolution than we might get from the consistent nationwide backbone. This integrated ocean observing system around the country is an end-to-end system, meaning it incorporates everything from actually taking the observations, either out in the water or from space or from the air, and then putting that into a data management and communication system that allows people to access the information from all these diverse platforms and sensors. And then finally, there's a component that allows the development of actual products or applications that can be used by different stakeholders. So just to give you an idea of where these regional systems are, this is a map of the 11 regional ocean observing systems as part of this nationwide effort. There are two in California. One is the Central and Northern California Ocean Observing System, which I represent, and there's also a complementary system in Southern California called the Southern California Coastal Ocean Observing System, and that extends from Point Conception south to the border with Mexico. And we're very much in coordination with that group. We have a memorandum of understanding, so we're trying to keep our resources coordinated and our efforts consistent. This is our geographic region, as I mentioned before. And also, as part of a regional ocean observing system, we're to incorporate some regionally significant variables. So if there are things that are really important to Central and Northern California, then we should certainly be including those in our monitoring efforts. This is the mission statement for our regional ocean observing system, basically part of the nationwide effort to provide actual data and data products to a diversity of end users. And these next three slides have an initial list of our partners in this observing effort. And this is an informal list, basically people that are interested, have been talking to us, participating in meetings, et cetera. Generally goes north to south, and you'll notice that there's everything from academic and research institutions to resource management agencies to nonprofits and for-profit corporations. And in this region, to date, we've had conversations with the Morro Bay, The blue. The Morro Bay National Estuary Project. Not working.
I think it turned off.
Okay. Anyway, you can see it in the middle there. California Polytechnic State University is one of our initial partners. It's been on our interim steering committee as we're organizing. We have a planning grant at this point from NOAA Coastal Services Center, and we have that grant through 2008. So that's the money that we're working from to do all this coordination activity. In terms of the observing activities in the region that we're trying to build from, many of these you probably recognize, or you may not. It's sort of the acronym soup here. We have many of these programs are actually providing information that's very relevant to some of the things that you're talking about, like the Marine Life Protection Act process. The CCOR program at the top there, for example, provides information on the bathymetry, habitat characterization. Oh, great. Habitat characterization and bathymetry, which can be useful for designating marine protected areas. Hyperspectral imagery, which can be used to identify kelp canopy, for example, at a very high resolution. There's also other programs like CIMT, which can provide surface current maps, also useful for marine protected area designations. satellite imagery of sea surface temperature and altimetry, or sea surface height and winds. Another big program that's starting up just now with some state coastal conservancy funding based on Proposition 40 and 50 funds is a statewide coastal ocean currents monitoring program. So there will be a consistent coverage along the whole coast of California for surface currents. So that's something that's really exciting. And unfortunately, I don't have time today to really go into detail about any of these, but I'm happy to come back in the future, or we can schedule a specific workshop for that. This is just to show a way to access some of the information that already exists from those existing programs. This is from our website, www.sencoos.org. We have links to near real-time and real-time data sets according to a number of different categories. There's satellite data, there's data from buoys, there's data from the high-frequency radar towers. There's also data from shore stations, like measurements are taken at piers. There's also data from tagged elephant seals and seabirds and other organisms. So this is a really useful site that allows you to get access to any of those things and see samples of the data sets, et cetera. Just quickly, I want to show you a little bit about the statewide Coastal Current Observatory. The gray area on the image you can see is showing the coverage where there will be surface current information available. That information will be available hourly on the web. There are a number of other components to this effort that I probably don't have time to talk about, but I will say that there are some areas where we'll have even higher resolution coverage of surface currents up to a 0.3 kilometer scale, so a fairly fine resolution of surface current information. The gray area will actually have a scale, a spatial scale of 3 to 12 kilometers, so that's a little bit of a grosser scale, but consistent coverage. This is just an example of one of the products that can be developed for anywhere. Once you have the statewide effort in place, you can get these animations of hourly surface current vectors, so you can see what the currents are doing in near real stations. And we have some specific committees on data management and engaging stakeholders and some other things. I just wanted to mention, too, and introduce really quickly Rondi Robeson, who's here. And she's the chair of our stakeholder or end user committee. And if you're interested in getting more involved in this, either she or I would be great people to contact. And we'd really love to have your input on how this program should develop, what kinds of things we should be measuring, and what kind of data products could be useful to you. Again, how we can help, we have a funding priority workshop every year, and these priorities get sent to the different federal agencies that are involved in ocean observing, and those get put into the federal budget process. So if there are things that you really think you need for this region, it'd be great to let us know about it for this workshop so we can incorporate it. We can also provide centralized access to existing and new data and data products. If you want a data product specifically that's developed for you, that's something we can help with. But if you want data that you can use in your own models or your own applications that you're comfortable with, then we can provide that as well. Provide outreach related to your priorities, and then finally your ideas. And this is really what drives this whole system, so hearing from you is really important. Just some information on how to get involved. And I'd also like to just suggest that we would like to have a stakeholder workshop somewhere in this area in the next year, and would think that maybe this group would be a great conduit to trying to get some people together to look at some sample data products, tell us if you think they're useful or not, or what other things you might really like to see. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks. Maybe you could fill that in. And Stephanie's offered to have us put a PDF file version of her PowerPoint presentation up on the website. And the website is there on the on the board. We're pleased to be able to use some pages off the NEP website, which they're graciously providing. This is an independent effort, the Marine Interest Group, but the NEP has been very supportive. When is that annual workshop about your priorities so that people would know when it would be timely to provide input to you?
Probably around February. So we had one relatively recently, February, March.
Okay,
but
you.
At any time, people have ideas just to send them along.
All right. Any brief questions or comments from members of the working committee or members of the public that have an interest in the research being done here? You provided some interesting data and pictures and illustrations, and they primarily focused on Monterey Bay. Does your data set fully include the Morro Bay area and this part of the Central Coast,
right?
So people could go online to the areas that you identified and find the same products that you've shown,
right,
for
there
Monterey?
That aren't developed yet, like the animation of the Monterey Bay surface current. That's not developed yet for this region in part because the system isn't installed here yet, but that will be coming online in the next year and a half. So there are other things that are available to you. I just didn't really have time to get them in for this presentation. But that's, again, something I'd be glad to do another time.
All right. Jeremiah.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie. I was just wondering, I didn't write fast enough to get all of the websites down. Well, I'm not quick with the pen, probably. But I was wondering if there is one website that would, I noticed there was a lot of weather-related, current-related, temperature-related websites. It seemed there was a few different ones. Is there any one website we could go to access all of them?
Right. That's the www.sencoos.org. Our website will allow, there's a data portal link right on the front of our homepage, and that's something that you can use to access many of those different data sets.
Okay. Thanks very much. I think Don's going to write on the board for us.
Okay. Oh, great.
Thank you very much.
Do I get that right, Stephanie?
Yes. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you. Well, the next part here is the report on the collaborative research activities. And this is really something that's been going on now, Dean, for when did the pilot begin?
A year and a half ago, it began
with just a small amount of money and the goodwill of the commercial party boat fishermen, Steve Moore, Darby Neal at Verges, and others that agreed to work with the scientists at Cal Poly to explore what could be done to evaluate
community, and from the World Wildlife Fund, and these people will all be acknowledged during the individual talks. And we have grown that into a much broader and more comprehensive effort, as you'll see evidence of tonight. And we're continuing to grow it. And at the end of the presentations, I'll try to talk a little bit more about how we're trying to expand this even further through our ecosystem-based management proposal right now to the Packard Foundation. So without further ado, I think we should start to move through some of the updates that we have. And we hope that you like what you see and that it's meaningful to you. So let's start first with Katie Gordon. And she's going to be talking to us today about one of our pilot projects, which has received a small amount of funding, you know, a handful of thousands of dollars. And she is a graduate student at Cal Poly. And she, along with her advisor, Francis Villablanca, have really developed a project that I think is going to shed some light on an older data set that we have from 1975 to 1980 about the pelagic birds in Estero Bay. So, Katie. Blue is the laser pointer, and you pull down to advance.
Maybe just a note of context here. what this group has been trying to do is really sort of take a look at different points in the food chain, if you will, and the health of the food chain related to the marine environment. And so the pelagic birds feed off the fish, so that they kind of give a reading of what's happening at that level. And then you're going to see some other studies about what's happening with the fish themselves, and then, you know, some other things that the fish eat, which are the sand crabs. So we're kind of taking a look through this at a couple different points in the food chain to get different readings of what's going on in these different communities and what can be learned from that. If you'd like to put on that lavalier microphone, that'll help you be heard better.
Don, while she's doing that, could you introduce our guest?
Sure. We're very thankful to have the support of all of our elected representatives from this area, both at the city level and at the county level with Supervisor Bianchi, and also with our state elected officials. Abel Maldonado has been an ongoing supporter of this now in the state Senate, and Assemblymember Blakeslee, his district representative Robin Hayhurst is here, and Assemblymember Blakeslee is the new member on the team here, but pleased to have his interest and support and your presence here with us. Congresswoman Capps is also actively involved in supporting, so we're thankful for that contribution, because when there's a need to talk with federal agencies or state agencies or county officials, all these folks have been very, very helpful in giving and providing access to that. So I encourage you to meet with Robin, you know, at breaks or after the session. Thanks for coming.
Okay. My name is Katie Gordon. I'm a graduate student at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department. And I was very pleased that this pilot study came to be, because it's the foundation for my master's thesis. So I'm very pleased to be here today to tell you a little bit more about it. So why do we care about seabirds? Why are we counting them? Why do we want to know it's out there? And Don mentioned that the seabirds, as the apex predator in the food chain, can be used as an assessment of the health of the ocean. It's kind of a broad term, but it gives you an idea of what's going on in the ocean. Secondly, out of the 66 species that are currently on my study list, 20 of those birds are species of special concern, which means they're either endangered, threatened, or on their way to one of those statuses. And finally, or not finally, but another way that this data is going to be used is by the oil spill response team. They're really eager to find out exactly what kind of birds are out there, so that if we did have an oil spill, they could properly respond to that and prepare for it. By knowing what types of birds are out there and where they are, they can address any kind of needs those birds might have. And finally, we have this excellent opportunity to compare what we find currently with this old data set, or existing data set from 1975 to 1980. So we can really compare what we've got now to what we had 30 years ago. So the objectives are pretty straightforward. We're going to go out and inventory what birds are there and how many of them, compare to the old data set to see what sort of changes may have occurred, and to detect any correlation between birds that we can see from land as well as from sea. So I go out on a boat and count birds, and then from land also count them and try to see, can we predict what's out in the ocean from standing on shore? And finally, one of the fishing that made it possible for us to get a boat once a month for the entire year. So the first step was to establish that core team. And again, I'd really like to highlight here the number of volunteers. There's the lead researchers. We're actually involved in the grant. But the naturalists, the student volunteers, Audubon, and all of the other volunteers, they're all volunteer. There's a huge group of people here that are working to bring this project to you, and most of them without any sort of pay involved. So the first step after forming that core team was to develop some methods. And what happened first was looking at the former study that was done, and looked at where they counted the birds, what methods they used to develop the methods and area for the current study. Secondly, we needed to acquire a suitable vessel. And this seemed like a pretty straightforward endeavor. We started out on this 17-foot boat here, provided by the California Department of Fish and Game, and after two pilot trips, determined that that was a very small boat for this study. So at that point, we spoke with Patriot, and we ended up on this lovely 65-foot boat, which made things a lot easier to collect some good data and invite everybody to come along. After getting the boat sorted out, I needed to establish waypoints and transects. The transects that were in the former study were by landmarks. It was from Morro Rock to the Union Oil Pier at Toro Creek, which isn't there now, and then to Cayucas and so on. So the first thing we did was go out and set GPS points so that we could just give the points to the boat captain and follow along that transect. And then finally, what were we going to do while we were out there? I needed to establish some protocols. So here is the actual study area. You can see that there are seven transects. It ranges from Point Bouchon to Point Estero. There are seven transects, and then there is another set of the coastal surveys. Those six green points are the coastal surveys. So this is the area that we're traveling. So what were the methods that we set up? The whole point is to count the birds and identify them. So in a distance 200 meters from the boat, we identify and count all of the birds that are out there. It's 180 degrees forward from the boat, so we're not trying to cover the entire 360. And I divide that area for two people, so each person has 90 degrees. There's these two principal observers and one recorder. Then finally, we have those seabird experts on hand to assist in identifying, and they float from side to side, so when the really interesting birds come in, they can make a correct identification. The boat travels at a constant 10 knots and record the time at the beginning and the end of each transect so that we can quantify a constant effort. Some of those transects are longer than others, so it's important to get a standardized rate of travel and time. Finally, I record the parameters of the environment. This is something that was not done to this extent in the previous study. There was a qualification of rainy or foggy, but not all of these parameters were recorded. And as I looked back, it would have been nice to have known that. So I'm hoping that by capturing these, that this will become an important data set long into the future. The first thing is the anemometer, which basically records the wind speed and direction and the air temperature in the atmospheric temperature. We try to qualify the wave height and chop by using the Beaufort scale. And then, again, a weather description, much like they did in the previous study, talking about hazy, high clouds, fog. And then we've got this piece of equipment called a CTD, which our deckhand Chris is holding here. And we lower that down into the water column, and it records the water temperature, water salinity, and the chlorophyll content of the water as the equipment goes through the 100 feet down to the extent of the line and then back up. So the output from that CTD is a graph like this. And I know that you can't read the tiny little words up there, but I'll walk you through it. So on this side here is the depth, and this is about 25 meters, which is about 75 feet. This blue line is the fluorescence, the green line is the temperature, and this red line is the salinity. And as you can see, the salinity stays fairly constant. The temperature, you can see, starts out warmer, and as you go further down, it gets a bit cooler. What's really interesting in this one is this big spike in the blue information. And remember, this is measuring the chlorophyll content in the water, which you can think of as being the photosynthetic algae or the plant matter that's in the water. That is the really, really base of the food chain. The plants in the water, then the fish, then the birds, and a lot of steps in between. So we get information like this for every transect point in between each transect for every time we go out. The land survey, which you can see this picture is from the boat, but I wanted to show the anemometer. This is the wind meter, and we take those studies, those recordings as well from land. The land study involves the bird count and identification. In this case, detections with this data set. The goals of that survey were to determine the species composition and relative abundance of pelagic marine birds found offshore in Morro Bay, Estero Bay. But out of 36 total outings, they got 33 data sets because for three trips they had to turn back because of weather. And 25 of those sets had transect details, so had the bird counts by transect, not just as a whole. And you can see that visually on this chart. The blue squares are trips that they took where we have complete data. The gray squares are ones that we have the sum of the whole trip, but it's not broken down by transect. And the black squares were trips that they had to turn back because of bad weather conditions. At the bottom here, you can see what we've done so far. 5 months of boat surveys and 2 land surveys there. And I'm very proud to say that out of 7 years, we got the first April data. It took 2 tries. We went out once and got turned back. Unfortunately, that was our first trip with Audubon, but they were very good sports. We were in very high seas, and they just sort of thought it was exciting, but we didn't see many birds that day. So I'm looking forward to having them out in July, hopefully in calmer seas. So I'd like to highlight here that these are very preliminary observations. We're comparing December, January, February, March, and April to an entire year's set. So this is not broken down by seasons. The first set here is comparing what we see from the boat to what we see on land. And you can see here that out of 39 species, 56% of them are only seen from the boat. And of those 56%, the groups include the alcids, the phalaropes, terns, jaegers, shearwaters, and all the gulls except the California and western gulls. There was one species that we saw from land that we didn't see from the boat. So this is very preliminary, but at this point, it really looks like we see different species from the boat than we see at land, which makes sense. They're seabirds. They're out further out. So comparing the initial data set to the current data set, and remember this is 5 months being compared to a whole year, the blue portion of the graph here shows those birds that are present in both data sets. Birds that are additional that we're seeing additionally here adds up to about 13%, and we're actually missing 8%. Now, remember, this is preliminary data. It has not been statistically analyzed, and we haven't completed a whole year. In addition to that, there have been some naming changes in birds, and we also have, I'm pretty certain that we have a more refined set of birders making identifications. For example, Tom Adell was on that current on those voyages in the current data set, and it's 30 years later. He's got 30 more years of bird experience to lend. So I think we're making some better identifications. So those birds that are missing are the eared grebe, Cassin's auklet, and the northern fulmar. We've seen both the eared grebe and the Cassin's auklet. It just wasn't during the transect. So outside of the data set, I can say that they're out there. The birds that we're seeing now that we didn't see then are the common tern, 2 types of Jaeger, black-finned shearwater, and glaucous winged gull. And these are not likely new birds to the area. The glaucous winged gull is a light-looking gull. It could have been mistaken for something else. Jaegers, there's few of them. They're usually in a big flock, in amongst a big flock of gulls, and might be hard to pick out. For example, here we show the Arctic tern versus the common tern. In the old data set, there were quite a few Arctic terns listed, and we're seeing common terns. These are two birds that are not showing up in the old set and are showing up in the new set. You can see here there are some differences when you look in the bird guide. It's always easier in the bird guide. But this is what it looks like in reality. So it's very easy, unless you're an expert birder, to be able to tell the difference. So it's likely that we are seeing much of the same birds, but at this point it's too early to tell, again, preliminary observations. One of the more interesting things that I've had the pleasure of seeing was on March 31st, we had high offshore winds. At one point, off of Cayucas, we had 25 knot winds, and that day we saw 5 hummingbirds a kilometer or more from shore, 2 flocks of tree swallows, an unidentified passerine just hauling back to shore, a little tiny yellow warbler also just trying to get back to shore, and a whole lot of painted lady butterflies. So it was really neat to be out there on a phenomena day where the wind was so high that we were seeing birds out there that we wouldn't normally see. I was very pleased to see the hummingbirds because in the old data set, they had a hummingbird one day, and I was like, are they crazy? There's no hummingbirds. And then I see 5. Also, on another trip, we saw an immature bald eagle just over the water at Point Estero. We were just about to stop, which would mean that we couldn't count it, and we saw it just in time to add it into the transect. So, and I also to highlight, the bald eagle is an endangered species, so there's another endangered species that is using this area. Any signals between the bird abundance and the environmental parameters. It's especially interesting with the CTD data. particularly the black vintage shearwaters, were here a lot later than we expected, but we think that's probably tied to some warmer currents. So it'll be interesting to have this whole range of data and apply it to the different birds and see how that turns out as signals. So that's the future work. And I'd like to thank the Marine Interest Group for getting this pilot program together, especially Marla Morrissey and Dean Wendt for bringing that to us. I'd really like to thank my expert naturalists, Tom Adele, Brad Schramm, and Bill Boughton. Without them, the data would be a whole lot of unidentified tern. Mike Harris helped us out with the boat there in the beginning. And a whole slew of volunteers. Kara Hagdern for arranging, organizing all of the Audubon trips. And the guys at Patriot Sports Fishing for being so flexible with the schedules. And finally, I'd really like to thank the Resource Legacy Fund Foundation for the funding, as well as the matching funds from the Morro Coast Audubon Society. So if you have any questions, that's the end of my prepared talk. Yes. Jeremiah?
Yeah, thanks very much, Katie. That's quite a task, quite a job there. I was just curious as how you would use comparative data that birds are pretty important to our industry because they work a lot better than even our electronics, actually.
Right.
And certain areas, I'll go to one area. As a matter of fact, I just went to Monterey Bay by boat and came back. And last year there was an absence of seabirds between Pedras Blancas and Point Sur. And this time on the way up there was a lot of birds. So that probably means I'll start our salmon season in that area. And I guess what I'm trying to get to is how you compare data because a pelagic would not necessarily return to the same area year after year. They would probably be following the groceries.
Right, exactly. Where the birds are and when they're there is very dependent on where the fish are, what the currents are like, what the weather is like, El Nino. There's all these factors, which is a good point to remind everybody that this is a pilot project. So part of this project is figuring out what do we study, where, what parameters do we need to have recorded. I think this study would be fabulous if we had this data once a month for 10 years. Then we're really going to see signals. In one season, we're capturing one climatological picture. We're capturing one generation. And hopefully we will see some signals that make a difference. But really this project, maybe in another 30 years somebody will do this and it'll be another comparative basis. But you're right, there's so many factors involved that it's going to be hard to see a definite clear signal initially.
If you get a good day, you might want to go up above the lighthouse. There's a couple of mile... Not a couple, it's probably a 4 mile wide swatch all the way up to Pedras Blancas. That's 30, 40 miles there.
Yeah, we've been watching the Pacific loons streaming by in huge numbers, and I know they're going by there. There's two of you, Dave.
Katie, nice presentation.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. The scheduling for this monthly sampling endeavor, is that well in advance, or how do you handle the details of keeping your volunteers notified and all of those little points?
This has actually been a lot of my effort has been placed. Initially, we were working with a donated boat and a donated boat driver, one of the scientists from California Department of Fish and Game, and then we were working around his otter schedule and the weather and work and school. And so once we got the charter with Patriot, I'm on the books with them once a month. I've got all my trips scheduled through November. However, I think I've rescheduled three of the five trips because of weather. Okay. The March trip was rescheduled five times. So I have this email list, and I'm constantly emailing, okay, it's missed. You know, it's going to be Tuesday, not Thursday. And mm-hmm. In fact, we were supposed to go today, but because of the weather, we ended up going Tuesday. So.
Okay. And a second question, do you mm-hmm. do the shore sampling the same date that you do the aquatic sampling?
Oh, good question. No, I do it the day after. The aquatic sampling, it takes about 6 hours. And so we leave Port San Luis at 6, usually start the transect at about 7, and we're done 4 or 5 hours later. So I go out the very next day, and I go out at the same time, so I start counting at 7, so that it's the same.
There is some correlation then.
Yeah, it's as close as I could get without it being the same day.
And are you still recruiting volunteers?
Always.
Okay.
Always.
How does one contact that process?
I suppose emailing me would be the best way. Kate Gordon.
Quick question. Is there any consideration giving to the phase of the moon or tides in these? The dates that are picked?
The dates at this point are picked when the charter boat's not out fishing and when I can go from school. I am trying to parameterize what we have. Initially, we were thinking, what's the optimum date? And because of weather and logistics, that wasn't possible. I try to go once a month and then record exactly what the parameters are. So that's a good idea. I should include the tides and the moon, too.
May or may not
be a signal, but.
And the other one is, if the sport boat gives out on you, it'd be interesting to see what you get if you went out on a bait boat.
Yeah.
Okay.
A dive.
Katie,
was there a reason that the common muir wasn't on the species list of the birds that you're counting?
It is one that we're counting.
Okay, I didn't see it on that list.
Yeah, I didn't put up a list of all the birds we're counting.
Okay.
I put up ones that either didn't compare. The birds that were listed up there were either not seen now but were seen 30 years ago or vice versa. So, yes, we're seeing lots of common murres as they did 30 years ago. Yeah, good question.
Okay. Well,
thank you very much.
Each of these topics is so exciting. We could spend a lot of time on it, but I know you've got four more that you're covering here. So.
So are we ready to go? Thanks a lot, Katie.
Thank you.
Yeah, I should mention this. The organism up here on the screen is not at all related to any of the research projects that we're talking about tonight. But this is a cute little polychaete worm that was just pulled out of Morro Bay about 2 days ago by one of my students who's studying invasive species in Morro Bay. And it's so attractive and pretty and odd looking that we thought we'd put it up. Four eyes, and look at all these appendages. Anyway, so now you know what it is. Even though we can't name it yet. How big is it? How big is it, Lisa?
Is it invasive?
We don't know yet. It looks like an alien, though. How big? Okay. Half an inch. Anyway, he's our poster child. So, next update is going to be a very brief update on the sand crab project, which was developed to look at as a potential model system to monitor the influx of novel pesticides into the marine environment. And so, Nancy, I don't know if you might have a couple words to say about it, or if you'd just like me to give the update that I know of.
I have more than a couple.
Excellent.
Not an expertise.
Yeah, terrific. So Nancy's going to talk about that.
Okay.
Thanks.
So thanks. I am working with Jenny Dugan from UC Santa Barbara, who is our sand crab expert, and Karen Worcester from the Regional Water Board, who the Regional Water Board, one of the things that they do is monitor pesticides in the environment. And my role is the MIG contact and also a toxicologist. What we're doing is looking down in the Santa Maria River estuary area where a lot of pesticides come down, and we're targeting a group of pesticides called pyrethroids. Now, if you've heard of them, you may think, oh, these aren't they the natural pesticides that come from chrysanthemum? And the answer is sort of. There's a group of pesticides called pyrethrins, which are naturally occurring, come from chrysanthemum. Pyrethroids are a semi-synthetic derivative of the pyrethrins, and the reason they were developed is the pyrethrins are very toxic and don't stick around very long. They're moderately successful. So the pyrethroids were developed to be more effective but less toxic, and that's sort of true about them. They actually are fairly toxic to marine organisms, and we're studying sand crabs for this project because the Santa Maria River dumps out onto a sandy beach. So many of the usual organisms that are used for toxicology studies don't live in that area. So we wanted to pick something that would actually be exposed to the pyrethroids that are coming down. Pyrethroids are used a lot in the Santa Maria Valley in the agriculture there. That's kind of the reason for this study. And Jenny Dugan from Santa Barbara has done a lot of work on the sand crabs. She knows where they are, when to go and get them. So she's been doing that work. And what we're doing right now, we have some very generous funding from the MIG that is allowing us to do tissue analysis. So she goes out, collects the sand crabs, grinds them up, and then we just analyze the amount of pyrethroids in there to my educated guess about what's going on there. So what we're doing is Jenny will be going out again very shortly to collect sand crabs. We'll do the tissue analysis. Unfortunately, tissue analysis is very expensive, the chemistry of it, and that's why we're only focusing on the pyrethroids. This is something that the water board, the regional water board, wanted because they are the most prevalent pesticides being used right now in Santa Maria Valley. And because we have limited funding, we decided to target this relatively new class of pesticides for our study. Where I come in and where we're right now in the process of looking for additional funding and expanding the scope of our project, my expertise is really in what effect do the chemicals have on the organism. So the chemicals are in the tissue, but big deal, does that really have any effect on the organism? What we'd like to do is study some of the what we call biomarkers of effect that show that the organism is dealing with these pesticides. And we know that with pyrethroids, insects, who is the target organism in crops, have enzymes that can metabolize these pesticides very quickly. And what it actually does for some of the insects is it allows them to survive the exposure to the pesticide. But the presence of those enzymes, we're anticipating finding them in the sand crabs because we find them in humans have the same enzymes. We have very similar enzyme systems in our liver for detoxifying chemicals that we're exposed to. What we'd like to do is look at the sand crabs and see if they have these enzyme systems, and if we see increased activity of these enzymes, that is tied in with the tissue analysis, would be an indication that they are exposed to these chemicals and that they're dealing with them, they're metabolizing them and trying to get rid of them from their system. So that's where we're hoping to go right now, but that's work that no one has done yet in the sand crabs at all. We don't know anything yet about these enzyme systems in the sand crabs. So our first step would just be establishing the procedures of how to do these studies. And then the next thing would be to tie them in with Jenny's tissue analysis work. So that's right now Jenny and Karen and I have been getting together and talking about sources of funding and ways to expand the scope, possibly to include some Cal Poly students as well, and continue on with this work. So that's really about all I have at this point for the sand crab study.
Do you have anything further, Dean?
No, that's thank you very much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
It's exciting. I look forward to seeing how it develops. So,
are there questions?
Oh, yeah.
Questions from the MIG members?
Of course.
Yeah, Marla, go ahead.
When the MIG first began, way back when we thought we might get selenium dumped into Estero Bay, remember, I don't know wherever that went, but there was a question to Jenny about, Nancy, measuring selenium in the sand crabs mm-hmm. as a baseline to see where the selenium was at. Is she going to be able to, is that important still to see what the sand crabs are doing with selenium?
It's, I'm a toxicologist, all toxins are important, but the problem is funding. The way that you would measure selenium levels is entirely different from the way you measure organic pesticides like the pyrethroids. So it would be another, it's typically $400 or $500 per sample. So that would be the problem right now. The reason why we are doing the pyrethroids is that we did have some funding from the water board, and that was what they wanted, and that's where we went.
But maybe if you're analyzing the selenium, would that help you get the funding better? I mean, would that be like the next thing to analyze, or are there other things that are more important to analyze before you hit selenium?
Well, in the Santa Maria River estuary, it's the organic pesticides, because it's so much of what's washing down are pesticides from the crops. And selenium is coming from, it doesn't come from agriculture, really. It comes from more industrial and oil refining.
Just a second thing. Some people know I try to do a lot of work with a western snowy plover. And the monitors, the breeding season started March 1st, and the monitors in Southern California are finding a lot of, unfortunately, dead western snowy plovers, and they are looking at the toxics with that. But again, it parallels heavy rains, mm-hmm. and they're eating the sand crabs, and it may turn out that these little birds are quite an indicator of beach pollution. So we'll try to let you know what they find out.
That would be great. And that's we've seen that when I was up in Monterey. We saw that in with DDT, a pesticide that's been banned for years in this country. After a big rainstorm one winter, it declined I think it was the common tern, one of the tern populations that was nesting in Elkhorn Slough, because the DDT, which
said this.
It'd be great. I mean, obviously, I have a bias, but I think it'd be nice to focus a little more attention at some point in the future in the Marine Interest Group on pollution, because it obviously has effects at every level of the food web.
Did you first start doing this when the river mouse first broke through, or was it before and after and or during and all that? I mean, Santa Maria river mouse takes a lot to break through, doesn't it?
Right now, it hasn't been very consistent, only, again, because of limited funding, but we're trying to target the times when we think there will be the most impact. So, like now, after a rainy winter. The spring is also, part of the reason why we do it in the spring as well is Jenny has another project going on where she's looking at, Joey was talking about all the sand crabs had eggs. So this is a time of year when they're reproducing. She's got a separate project going on with that, with the reproduction. So that's another reason why we do it in the spring. But actually, one of the things we would like to do as well is tissue analysis of the adults and tissue analysis of the eggs, because eggs being fatty tissue is where a lot of organic chemicals get stored. And so it would be interesting to see if more of it is getting into the eggs or is being stored in the body of the organism. But again, that's something we haven't been able to get to quite yet. We're just getting started here.
Great. Thanks so much, Nancy. I know other people may have questions, but to just be fair to the next researchers, I think we need to move on. And if you've got additional questions for Nancy, please check up with her at the end.
And Nancy, we should talk, because I think there is probably going to be a good opportunity, perhaps even with the ecosystem-based management, to maybe fold in some of this as part of our proposal. So we're going to continue on with another pilot project. And what that means is that it was recently started and it doesn't have a lot of funding. But not that it's not going really well. And it's a collaboration between Royden Nakamura at Cal Poly and Carlos Morales at Cal Poly. He's an undergraduate student. And two commercial trap fishermen, Tom Hafer and Roger Cullen. And they've got some really exciting data to show you guys about their recent work tagging these species. So what's going to happen is Royden is going to start, introduce the project, and then Carlos is going to present some of the data, and then Royden's going to come back and finish presenting the rest of the data. So without any more delay, Royden, please. You should know how to use that. It's yours.
Oh, and Royden, you need to put the microphone on the level there. There.
Thanks, Don.
Please.
See, if you had worn a tie, Royden, we would have been able to.
Looks like the
animation.
Okay. You know, last time I made a presentation, I went through actually quite a bit of detail trying to explain some of the things that we thought we need to get for some what I call sort of quote-unquote grassroots level type information to give us information about certain fisheries, fisheries resources, particularly in this particular area. And so I'm going to start out just by sort of synopsizing some of our objectives and how we went about trying to put this program together. And what you see here, I've synopsized some of these objectives here. One of the things you want to do is know something about movements of cabazon, site fidelity, that is to say, you know, how strictly do they stick to one particular area. We wanted to also obtain what I call high-resolution fishery data. That includes high-resolution fishery statistics. And we also wanted to use that statistics in the sense that we want to have them highly standardized as we can, because this is always a problem. We also want to obtain information. In this case, I have your listed estimates of abundance of for this particular area that is specific to the South Central Coast, and that has been a concern of the fishing community. Along with the estimates of abundance, of course, we're interested in the usual traditional catch statistics. And something that often goes by the wayside, we kind of not think about it too much once we start doing this, is this last one here. And actually, this is a trend that we're seeing nationwide. You know, people are starting to recognize the importance of doing collaborative work. And so I needed to remind us of that particular thing. Now, this is a pretty busy, you know, it's the old story about you can have the best models in the world, but if the primary data that goes into it is sort of loose, you know, things start to fall apart. So, you know, that's our point of view as we try to design these types of experiments. The results to date that we're going to present to you today, this is just based on our first-tier analysis, that is our first pass through the data, which means that we have a lot of teasing to do of the data. That has to come later, but we're going to talk about movement and site fidelity, population size, catch characteristics, catch per unit effort. We're also going to look at the size contribution, size distribution, I should say, and size is related to age. We're going to look at that distribution relative to the population that we sampled. And finally, we're going to have on here some approximations, and I would like to emphasize these are preliminary approximations, and it's not the sort of stuff that we put out right now. It's not the sort of stuff, well, it's the sort of stuff I don't want to see on the internet yet, because we really need to validate this, okay? But I feel obligated to let you folks see this, because this is why we're doing this, all right? I just want to emphasize that, you know, we're going to stick our necks out a little bit here, but I don't mind doing it for this group right here. So we'll start out with having Carlos, and I'll introduce you to Carlos, who will cover this first category here. Carlos Mireles, you know, one of the real yeomen of this operation here. He's basically the main guy in the field, so I'll let you go ahead, Carlos.
Give him the mic.
Oops. Hold a sec.
Thanks, William. Okay, so I am in charge of analyzing the movements, and that's what I'm presenting on today. So all the movements are based on GPS coordinates of the initial and recapture of the fish, of the tagged fish, and then I analyze it using a GIS computer application. So this is our tagging range here. We started in north of Cayucas at about Killers Reef and extended about 12 miles up the coast to Cambria. In that time, we tagged 1,239 fish. From August 9th through December 15th. And you see each of these tags has their own, has their distinctive color and individual tag numbers so we could better track the fish. This orange buffer here represents a half mile distance from shore. So you can see that most of our tagging effort occurred within that half mile band. And most of our tagging, most of our captures of fish occurred in this area right here on Estero Reef. So from these fish, we had 93 recaptures. 51 of these recaptured fish came from the commercial fishermen in Morro Bay. And you can see they're represented here by the square colors. These are the initial initial locations of capture. And five of these fish were actually were captured more than once in the study. So as I then, if you can see here, there's these smaller areas and the smaller little points here, and those represent where the fish were recaptured. And from this scale, it's really hard to kind of see. So as I zoom in here to the circle, you can see that these are the movements of the fish. And something that we kind of have to keep in mind here is that these aren't, you know, this is a linear distance right here. So we don't know exactly what happened in between this time that the fish were initially captured and where they were recaptured. You can see here the scale is 100 meters. And this fish right here is just right about 100 meters in distance from the initial to the recapture.
Carlos?
Yes?
What was the time period between the capture and the recapture? Did it vary between
those? Yeah, it varied between all fish. I'll show you a few examples coming up, varying time frames of initial and recapture events. So here's an example right here of two fish that we caught in the same trap, tags 175 and 176. They were caught on 905, captured on 95, and tag 175 here at 150 days at large. Was captured 98.7 meters from its initial location of capture, and tag 176 after 131 days at large moved about 29.4 meters. So we can't say that there is a difference in the movements between sexes. So this is an example right here of a multiple marking recapture. This is tag, I'm not sure if I have the tag number here, but it was initially caught on 12/15. It was captured later on that day, 71.9 meters away. 36 days later, it was recaptured 116.7 meters away. So we kind of get an idea, you know, if we would have just caught this fish here and then caught it there, we'd have only thought that, you know, they'd only moved about 50 meters from that area. But we have caught it twice, so now we kind of get a better idea of home range for these fish. We have even a better idea from one fish that was recaptured three times after being initially caught, tag 303, which could also... it could suggest maybe learned behavior with these fish in the trap, something that we should also think about looking into the future. Tag 303 was initially caught on 9/6, 11 days at large. It was captured 43.4 meters from the initial location of capture. 110 days later from that, it was caught 100.6 meters away from that second recapture event, or first recapture event, excuse me. The third recapture event occurred on 118, 24 days after recapture event 2, and it had moved 137.9 meters from the recapture event 2. So it had a total of 145 days at large. And this kind of gives us an idea of where these fish are moving. They're staying. Looks like they're staying in a relatively same area. We're not seeing these really long distance movements. And from the initial to this area is probably about 40 meters. So analyzing this data, we determined that the average distance between the capture and recapture events was 67 meters for fish, for all the fish. So then we kind of analyzed the data more, and I was thinking, you know, are these fish even capable of traveling longer distances than this? And they appear to be displaying high levels of sight fidelity, but we later were able to confirm this with a translocation portion of the study that we did. We took 41 fish and relocated them. These are all the translocated fish here, their initial recapture or their initial capture points. There's 19 blue tags here, 19 blue tags that we translocated to this area, 22 green tags which we translocated to this area, and out of these, we had a 12% recapture of 5 fish. So what we learned that we added these 5 fish that we recaptured from the translocated fish, we had the shortest distance of translocation from this area to here being 0.98 miles, and the longest distance being 2.68 miles from this fish. And as you can see, when they were translocated here, their recapture events were right here with the smaller tag, designated as a smaller tag point, green, blue, right there, right there. So then all 5 fish that were recaptured did move exactly back, not to the exact same spot, but within the same area as where they were first captured. So that does suggest high degrees of homing behavior. So then I took the distance and measured from the initial to the recapture event with this right here. And as you can see, the closest proximity to the initial place of capture was 14.3 meters. The furthest was 166 meters by this fish. And the average proximity for all 5 of these fish was 50.6 meters within their initial location of capture. When you look at the average for the non-relocated fish, the distance from the initial location of capture, 67 meters. So it's within that. So some of the conclusions from the movements is that fish on average are caught 67 meters from the initial capture location. Approximate. So this 67 meters, we then use that to just make an approximation of home range for these fish, which then we calculated to be about, if you take a point and you draw a circle around it, the area around that point is going to be about, think of it as a circle with a diameter of 150 yards for each of these fish, home range. The greatest distance that a non-relocated fish was recaptured from the original capture location was 366 meters, or about 0.22 miles. And there was only one fish that was recaptured that had a distance from its initial capture point of over 300 meters. There was 2 fish that were 8 fish to sex that are frozen right now that I still haven't got a chance to get to yet. But, from out of these fish right here, there was... out of the fish that I did at sex, it looks like about 25% of the catch that we caught was that we had returned to us was male, and the rest 75% being female.
Okay, well, let's. If there are other questions that you think of, Carlos will take those as well as Royden after Royden finishes the rest of the talk. Looking at some of the population parameters. Thanks, Carlos.
Just to fill in while they're translating, transferring the microphone here, can someone speak maybe briefly, I don't know, Tom Haffer or others, what's the commercial interest in or human interest in Cabazon, and why might somebody want to know where they move?
Roy, do you want to take that?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I just thought that people who are viewing this would like to have a little background. What's the human interest in Cabazon, and why might you be interested in knowing if and how they move?
Well, actually, the Cabazon, has been one of the nearshore fisheries that has had its share of controversy. And among other things, we can bring in questions, for example, on another project we're working on is trying to identify different stocks. In other words, if all the Cabazon up and down the coast of California, or entire Pacific coast for that matter, are all of the same stock, genetic stock, that means it's okay that we can treat them all as one, whatever management policies you come up with. However, should we find great genetic differences, then we're going to have to re-examine that question and say, are the stocks that are genetically different, we'll say down in South Central California, if they're different from Northern California,
then the rules and regulations may not apply as tightly to what we have down here versus up there. So, you know, there's that. The movement thing is also important, because if one wants to try to look at standing stocks of fish in a resource, you know, if you have a highly mobile group of fishes, a species, then it's really hard to pin down what that stock actually is at any given point in time. And so site fidelity, home range, all of that is really important, because it gives us another insight into whether or not, you know, how consistent that population will be in terms of numbers staying there versus something moving in, moving away, moving out. And so, you know, there's a lot of aspects to this, and they're tied into the ecology of the population itself.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Carlos got to talk to you about what I consider some really interesting stuff. And so it's my job to bring up the rear end here, and with some of the more mundane sorts of things. So I'm going to proceed and do that. And we can still be linked to what Carlos did, because Mark recaptures studies whenever we do this. You know, one of the things that we can get from this, in fact, it's an important way of trying to get population estimates. And so this is what we wanted to get out of that study also. Now, I need to back up just a little bit just to let people know that when we do mark recapture studies, or like many other protocols that we use, you know, there's some assumptions that we have to make. I mean, that's the nature of a lot of what we do in science. And so in this particular case, the basic assumption is that during the time that we do this study or this analysis, there are no major changes going on in this population. And the changes, for example, may result from, we're talking about changes such as immigration, emigration, that is, members of the population leaving the population, leaving the area, or new members coming in. You know, we can't have this dynamic going on, because it'll do, obviously, alter the outcomes. Similarly, demographic features such as mortalities, rates of recruitment, we need to make those assumptions that they're going to be at least constant, or if they're not going to be constant, we need to have a handle on them, okay? And so we need to recognize some of that. The approach used in trying to decide what kind of model we're going to use, I had to put this rather busy overhead up here, but I'll try to walk you through it here. First of all, I want to keep this as simple as possible. And we had something helping us to keep it simple as possible, and the reason was budgetary limitations. But it was a blessing in disguise, because what it did was it forced us to try to start this, and remember, this is a pilot study. This forced us to work within a relatively short, and they're much more difficult to deal with. The closed model also, in using the closed model, we were helped by the fact that the ecology of the Cabazon is such that we know it's a benthic species. It's not a schooling species in the water column. It's not swimming around all the time. It's usually kind of hanging around in some substrate area. And what that suggests is that these things are not going to be moving, you know, all the time. And that fits well with trying to use a sort of a closed model, because we're meeting this assumption that, you know, we're going to minimize changes occurring within the population we're trying to study. However, we did have an open option of having, I should say, an alternative option, or I should say additional option, of including an open model. This was dependent on the numbers of tags we could get back, and also it was dependent on some other information that we needed to fit into the model. The information we have up to this time didn't allow us to fit into an open model very easily. We can squeeze it in there, but the outcome is not good, so it has too much uncertainty in it, so we didn't really use that. All right, so just to sort of give you some spatial relationship to this, I use this other graphic here. The area that Carlos was describing for you is shown here in this Fish and Game publication that shows some blocks. That's actually a very colorful graphic right here, but the area we're talking about is in this block 608, And I want to remind you that we're really concentrating on the coastal areas here. Since I have this graphic up here, this is derived from a compilation of Cabazon landings up and down the California coast. Some of you fishermen probably have seen this. But what it did was that it also tried to look at, what you say, catch for effort here. But also, you might know that they also tried to quantify the catch that was derived on a given year for this area. In this case, this is Morro Bay. But if we go up to this block, this particular block, historically, the landings that were derived from this area here range from about 500 to 32,000 pounds. Again, the discrepancy, I suspect, is related to emergence of the trap fishery, greater demand for Cabazon, so on and so forth. Nonetheless, I just want to sort of put a face on where we are and try to link what Carlos is doing to the fact that all of this is still tied to some basic fisheries problems. This little overhead is one that Carlos has a different version of it. Again, just to reiterate this thing that we're working along this really narrow band along here. And in fact, the isobaths that we're working with go from 1.5 fathoms out to 10 fathoms. So that's that narrow band along the coast, okay? So we want to remember that. Because whenever we use any numbers, people might start thinking, well, that must be all up and down the coast. That's not true yet. We don't have enough information to do that sort of extrapolation at this point. So if I look at population estimates, and I'll get rid of this right here. This Jolly Seaver, we'd like to use it. We may be able to eventually, if we get more information, and if we can do a replication of this study, we certainly will be able to. I'm using these two models here. I'll just take this one on the top here, Schumacher model. These are both multiple census models. That is to say, we go out, you fish, and you tag, and you release. You go out and fish and tag and release. You do this multiple times. And so the population estimate for that particular area where the study was being done is 18,504. That's a population estimate. Now, over here on the right, I have a 95% confidence interval that's shown right here. And what that 95% confidence interval is, it's like if we did this experiment 100 times, okay? 95 out of 100 times, we're going to get a population estimate that's going to be someplace between these two numbers, 13655 and 28694. It may not be 18504, but it's going to be someplace in between here. So that's what our 95% confidence interval is telling us. So we have this other Schnabel model here, and it has a slightly different estimate, 18422. We also have a 95% confidence interval. Now, these two models have slightly different things, and I can't really go into the statistical reasons for this, but it really has to do with some of the components in the calculations, whether they follow certain distribution patterns or not, statistical distribution patterns. So, you know, we don't want to go there. All I'm going to tell you is, you know, these are both valid models, and they have slightly different assumptions built into them. But, you know, and the trap fishery, we use the catch per unit effort measure is catch per trap per hour. 44 traps on a set. You soak them for, on the average, 2.6 hauls. And then you haul them up, you get the fish, you count, you weigh the fish, you measure the fish, tag the fish, toss them back out. So ultimately, we can derive numbers like this. And the value of this number, these numbers, is that we can make more valid comparisons, okay? And so our measure then for catch per unit effort is catch per trap per hour for the trap fishery for this particular study area. We may do this study like we wanted to do further north, in another proposal, but that's another story. We might come out with totally different numbers, okay? So, but we can at least compare them, because we'll have a standard to compare these data. So let me run you through some of these graphics here. Here's a graphic or chart that shows you catch by set. I might mention we had 10 days to do this, 10 days spread over actually quite a few weeks, many weeks. And if you look down here, we have set. And on any given day, 3 sets were done. All right? So you see first day, set 1, set 2, set 3. On this axis here, you have numbers. How many fish did they catch? And using the same methodology, the same numbers of traps and so on. And actually, the numbers, you know, not surprisingly, you know, would vary because you're also moving around. There's other things that affect the catch data, and so you can see this is what the quantification, summation, I should say, of the catch, total catch in this case, laid out by numbers. How many fish do they catch? I believe the average number falls someplace around 43 or something like that. If we were to convert this to catch per unit effort, again, you see the same layout here. Over here, catch per unit effort, in this case, numbers of fish per trap per hour, okay? And so you can see that we get funny-looking numbers here, but, you know, when we run the data through that, this is what we come out with. But the beauty is, of course, these numbers are readily comparable to any other data we might get when we would replicate this experiment, go up north, go down south, and do this experiment. We can now make some valid comparisons. No more comparing apples and oranges. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. Maybe no more comparing, you know, Valencias to tangerines or something like that. All right? This is another depiction. This chart here shows you some of the catch, in this case by set, and also shown in this case by biomass, either kilograms or pounds. I think one of these charts I found out on my way down here, actually, that we have a discrepancy in scale, but that doesn't change what we're going to see here. I just want to point out something on this. I know we had had 21 sets where we could actually measure weight, okay? But we had significant amounts of information there to allow us to do some analysis there. I also want to point out this set number 12. Set number 12, you see this really low number. That's very misleading. That was the day that the digital scale on board the boat, you know, just crashed. And so for the rest of the day, you know, the guys couldn't measure any of the fish. But we had to put it in here to let you know that, yeah, we were still catching fish that day. It's just that this number is anomalous. This number, you know, every time when I talk to Carlos about this, what went on that day? I mean, you can see one day things went really well. And so sometimes you get these and maybe Tom can tell us. I understand this was just before a storm. It rained that day. But, hey, I'm not a fisher. You guys know all this stuff, right? So we do have variations that do occur like that. Now, if one was to look at catch per unit effort by set, in this case, this is by kilograms. Maybe I'll do this one by weight. The catch per unit effort, in this case, pounds per trap per hour, okay? And, you know, my memory serves me correct, this probably ran around 2.4 or something like this. But this is the type of data that we're getting. It's highly standardized as best as we can. We try to do everything the same over and over. Now, this next overhead here shows you sort of a weight frequency distributing, because I will tell you that, you know, things aren't as they seem right here, because we need to recognize the fact that any gear you use has some level of selectivity. In other words, it doesn't uniformly catch all the entire array of fish within a population, in this case, as we sort them out by size. In the case of the traps on Tom's boat, they all have these otter exclusion rings. And what that means, it excludes some of this larger fish. The larger cabazon, I don't know what the largest is now, but last I read it was, what, 39, 40 inches or something like that. But all I'm telling you is that once we get up to around 20, 21, you're not catching all those big fish. They're not showing up, okay? So that's a bias in your data, but we recognize it. We know what it's about. And obviously, it alters what we see here. Over on this end here, there is a certain amount of gear bias also. And in this case, these smaller fish down here, in fact, this little guy got in there. But for the most part, any fish that might have been this small, if they were there, probably got out of the trap, okay? So what I'm trying to tell you is that, you know, there are, that we need to recognize there's an absence of some of these smaller fish up here, of that component of the population, and the larger fish component over on this end. Nonetheless, we can still do a lot with this curve and with this distribution graphic here. Now,
we need to be wrapping up this section in fairness to the next two groups that are coming forward.
Okay, I'm finished that right on. This is my last slide, actually. Okay. So, this is the average size here. I'm sorry, the legal size. And what I want you to get out of this is, if you know, if this sampling here, about, actually it's 52% of the harvest of the sample we took were of legal size fish, shown right here. All down here, and so the remainder are sublegals. And so, you know, we can start to extrapolate some of that. And I'll skip over some of these other things. So let me get to this. This is a summary table here. We can tell you that the cabazons show a high degree of site fidelity, and we know, well, it appears that homing behavior is a very strong, has a strong presence. We can also tell you that you know, the populations in the area that we sampled is running around, well, 18,000 plus, again, depending on which analyses you want to use. And if one was to look at the, you know, catch data averages, we can give you some numbers. For example, the average size is 3.4 pounds, the average catch per unit effort is 2.4 pounds, and so on. Now, preliminarily, it would appear that, well, if one accepts that sample that we showed there as reflecting the whole population, within that area that we sample, is we can say that there probably are around over 9,000 fish that are of harvestable size within that area. And if one wants to go even further, and I'm always reticent to do this because I don't want to see this on the internet. This is preliminary, unpublished thing. We need more work on this. But one wants to try to look at the quantifiable biomass within the study area. We're talking about 75 plus thousand pounds, whereas in the historic yields shown in one of the earliest graphics I showed you, the high then was about 32,000 pounds. But again, I reiterate, this is preliminary, and we still need to do more work on this. I just want to say that, you know, what we need to do is to, we need to replicate the study and do it exactly the same, and we can really make the data we have even more robust and come up with some even more consistent types of approximations. And so I just want to acknowledge all these people out here. There's so many people who helped out on this project, and of course, you know, the Legacy Foundation, which helped us fund this.
Okay. If we have time, we'll take time for a brief question. If there's a quick one or two. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Thanks very much for the terrific presentation, Roy and Carlos, both. And I just want to say that the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization is very happy that you are using a couple of our members for collaboration. And we are strong supporters of collaboration. I hope other researchers use you gentlemen for an example. And we've always been proponents of collaboration, and we've seen very little in the past. We hope that changes in the future.
And is involved in the study.
This area that we fish, Amazons, has been fished hard for the last 12 years by all the nearshore guys, and the day after the season was stopped, the quota was full, we went out and started our tagging project. We had 160 70 fish or 168 fish that same next day. So you can see how fast and how much fish is out there by just by doing this. There's so much fish out there that it shows it by this tagging project, because how hard we've been fishing it for the last 10 years. Because all the nearshore guys go there and fish it every day, you know. So that kind of proves how much really the nearshore is thriving right now. So we need to be protected.
All right. Great. So we're going to be moving on. We have two more talks in 10 more minutes. But what's new? So get a cookie. Our next talk, too late, cookies are gone. Our next talk is by John O. Wilson. He's a master's student in the biological sciences department. And he's going to be telling us about the work that he started last year looking at rockfish recruitment in San Luis Obispo County. John O.
So first off, I'd like to thank Dean, Royden, and John for helping me start this project. And it essentially deals with patterns of rockfish recruitment along the south central California coast right here, San Luis Obispo County. So a little bit about rockfish life history that I'm sure many of you know already. Rockfish release their larvae and their live when they're released during the winter and spring months, and then the currents transport the larvae up and down the coast. And to some extent, these fish can swim. And as they transition into pelagic juveniles, as they grow older and older, they can swim a little bit better. So as they can swim better, in roughly through March through September, they make this transition into the nearshore environment where they find adequate habitat in the kelp beds and rocky substrate, and this is known as the settlement event. So you get this input of individuals into the nearshore environment, and some of them will undergo some migration, they'll leave that location, and others will be preyed upon, undergo some post-settlement mortality. And the ones that remain and actually are inputted into the population in this one area is known as recruitment. So recruitment is essentially this number of settlers that are input into the population minus the ones that die or emigrate from that area. And settlement and recruitment are extremely important to know for a number of reasons. And first off, fisheries managers use indexes of settlement and recruitment to predict future stock biomass. So you know how many fish are coming into the population, you can predict how many there will be in the future if you know mortality rates as well. So you can also determine where and in what numbers these fish are living and perhaps correlate that with habitat characteristics. And you can also identify what are the key environmental conditions that produced these good conditions, strong year classes. So rockfish are, typically undergo years of poor recruitment followed by 1 year where there will be this strong year class. And if you know why that happened, and if you follow settlement recruitment patterns, it'll be great for the fishery to understand why this is happening. So in the past, a number of people have studied recruitment, and in particular recruitment and not settlement, because settlement is pretty hard to follow and pretty hard to study, because you'd have to be out in the water on a daily basis, if not an hourly basis, to see how many settlers are coming into the environment. So more typically, people do diver surveys or things like that during the fall after those individuals have migrated out from that area or have undergone this mortality. Diver surveys, light attraction devices, trawling. You can go out in the ocean and actually do larval tows or juvenile pelagic tows, where you get an index of how many will recruit or settle into the population. And then more recently, an individual up at UC Santa Cruz developed this technology, if you'll call it a technology, known as SMURFs, which are standard monitoring units for the recruitment of reef fishes. And these have a number of inherent advantages over the other methodologies, because SMURFs, what you do is you actually position these in the water column about 100 meters offshore of the kelp beds, and they're fixed in a permanent location and buoyed up at the top. And you position these SMURFs at different depths in the water column, depending on what you're actually going for. And these Smurfs are essentially just rolled plastic green fencing. You just make it into a cylinder and stuff it with more black fencing. And these fish, you can see the mesh is about 1 inch on there. And these little baby rockfish, when they're coming into the nearshore environment, use it as their habitat. And so they can escape predators by going inside of it. They find adequate food in the water column. And they essentially just treat it as their home. So once every 2 weeks are vent. So this is kind of the intermediate step, which is critical to understand. So what I did in 2004 was I designed this nested study where I had three sites, San Simeon, Cayucas, and Shell Beach. And at each site, I had two sets of four Smurfs that were spaced a kilometer apart. So what this allowed me to do was to see if there were differences at different spatial scales. So at the 1 kilometer spatial scale, at 30 kilometers, and then at 60 kilometers. And what I found was some neat trends. But before I get into some of this analysis, let me explain how I'm representing some of these data. So the black yellowtail and olive rockfish, they look remarkably similar to one another at this young age. They're extremely closely related to each other. And they share similar morphological characteristics and meristic characteristics. So in the literature, previous studies have actually grouped these together, and I'm doing the same until I get the results of some genetic analysis where I will actually be able to conclusively say this was black and this was yellowtail and this was olive. So for this study, or for this presentation actually, I'm calling the black yellowtail and olives the BYO complex, and the copper gopher and black and yellows the CGB complex. Okay, so into some of this temporal variation. What I found was that typical of other settlement studies that have been done in the past on the Central Coast, the black yellowtail and olive recruit earlier from about May to July. The copper gopher and black and yellows are a little bit later in the season. And cabazon typically are fairly constant throughout the settlement season with obvious increases in the first 4 months or so. And so what I'm going to do with some of this temporal variation is actually examine the otoliths of hopefully a few of these fish, but in particular cabazon. And what the otoliths are is they're inner ear bones of the fish, and they deposit this calcified layer on a daily basis. And so much like growth rings in a tree, you can actually count the number of rings and find out the age that these fish are. And so I have these little juvenile fish, and I remove the otoliths, and I can actually back calculate the day that they hatched from their eggs, in the case of cabazon, or they were released from their mothers, in the case of rockfish. And then so what I can do is I can estimate or get an estimation of what the environmental conditions were on that day, the day they were released, the day they were hatched, and the day that they settled, to see if there's any trends that are apparent throughout the settlement season. And so now getting into some of the spatial variation, what I found was, if you look on my graphs here, along the horizontal axis, I have the three different locations. And then on the vertical axis, I have basically an average number of fish per Smurf per collection. And what I'm doing here is I'm analyzing just north versus south differences. So remember, I had two sets of four Smurfs that were spaced a kilometer apart. So the south cluster is the yellow. The gray cluster is the north. And so I'm comparing just south versus north within each site, and I didn't find any spatial differences at this 1 kilometer scale, which is pretty significant because it's saying that these fish are actually settling at this constant spatial pattern over 1 kilometer. And so any differences that you might find after that would definitely be due to habitat characteristics. These fish are coming in at a constant rate over the scale, but then they choose to go at a later stage to these different habitats. Now, at the bigger spatial scales, I did find difference. So when I examined just total rockfish, the sites were significantly different, and so I did some statistical analysis on that and found that it was actually Shell Beach that was really significantly different from San Simeon. Cabazon was also extremely different from site to site. The sites that were driving this difference were San Simeon and Cayucas. So I actually found most cabazon at San Simeon, whereas the most rockfish were at Shell Beach and not at San Simeon. So thinking about some of these trends, I've come up with a number of hypotheses. But for this presentation here, what I want to discuss is this pattern, this declining trend from south to north. So I got the most number of rockfish at Shell Beach, and Cayucas was second most, and San Simeon was last. So started asking, why this might be. And one of the things I came up with is this hypothesis on current patterns. And so we know the California Current is a southerly flowing current along the west coast of North America. Comes down here, and it's actually been shown and modeled that it gets deflected off these headlands and creates this eddy effect or this relaxation of waters to the lee of these headlands. And so Point Bouchon, which is right here, being this largest headland in my study, I'm thinking that that might be the reason why I saw the most number of fish below here. There's this relaxation of waters. Perhaps it's ideal settlement habitat for these rockfish. It just so happens that Point Estero right here is the second largest headland in my study. I got the second most number of fish. Point Piedras Blancas is the smallest headland. I got the least amount of fish. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to test to see whether this is actually occurring or not. So due to budgetary constraints, as we say, in that with this study right here. And so what I'm also going to be doing is taking CTD measurements. Katie earlier mentioned the CTD. It measures chlorophyll, temperature, and salinity. So every time I go out, I'm going to actually drop a CTD right here, well, at each one of these sites. And so I'm going to see, and with that data, you can actually see whether these are different water masses. So if they have different salinity content and different chlorophyll content, they might actually be different water masses. So is this offshore water mass significantly different from this water mass? And am I seeing these differences? So it'll be just another data point to correlate with my abundance estimates. And that's that.
Questions
actually,
for Jana?
Let me, forgot my acknowledgments. I went back here, so let me acknowledge a few people. Central Coast Salmon Enhancement and Freddie Audie loaned me their boat and a lot of assistance. Colin, Aaron, Nicole, and everybody else who helped me dive. Arnold, Jen, Neosha, and Steve Rain with helping me set up the project and some statistical advice. The Marine Interest Group, obviously, for the impetus to begin this work. Port San Luis Harbor District gave me all the chain for all my anchors. And the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary for allowing me to sample up in San Simeon. Landlord, and some funding for, awarded to Dean Wendt from the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, as well as the Cal Poly Student Fee Committee. Thank you. You don't need to clap again.
All right. Any questions for Jono?
You know, one thing that we heard from, I think it was Steve Ralston when he came and talked about how the regulators do their science in tracking rockfish and so on. Mm-hmm. Are any of the measures that you use in the SMERFs, are they used also by the scientists that are evaluating for determining rockfish season and so on? Are there any similarities of what you looked at and what they look at? And
They don't actually use SMERFs. SMERFs were just developed actually in 2004, so hopefully in the future they will be, because they, in my opinion and a couple other people's opinion, are a really good indicator of settlement and recruitment. So we're trying to make this transition into getting this coast-wide distribution of SMERFs, and maybe that will help better predict stock biomass and whatnot. So as of right now, no. But one of the projects that I was hoping to be able to do was to do some larval tows that actually the managers do offshore and correlate that with my SMERFs. But again, budgetary limitations haven't allowed me to do that. So it would be a great study for someone else to do in the future.
Any other questions people might have?
So the cow coffee data is sort of hard to find.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they don't really come down here as significantly as they do up in Monterey Bay, yeah. I'm still thinking about trying to be able to correlate something with that, but we'll see. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, John. So we're moving into our last talk for the day. And this is a study, this is our longest standing study. This was started a couple years ago. And John Stevens is going to be presenting today the data from our collaborative research with the commercial passenger fishing vessels. So we're going to get set up. And this is one of our, I think one of our greatest successes. It's been a terrific collaboration that started as a grassroots project, and we're very fortunate to have John here, who's really spearheaded the technical expertise to carry this project out. So, John, please.
Thank you, Dean. Dean mentioned this five-person meeting in the motel. It was in a restaurant.
Denny's. That's right.
I was part of that.
Yes, you were.
Just saying, geez, you've got to do something, and it shouldn't cost as much money. So we started looking at party boats, because there had been a party boat data set, and Steve Moore and everybody said, you know, the Rockfish data is good. It looks really good. Fish and Game did 10 years of it. Of course, it never got published, so it's just sitting there. You can use this as a data set, and we'll continue it. So that's one of the things we're going to do here. I might point out,
move the side one down.
Move the side one down. No, I just wanted. I want to point something out.
Oh,
blue.
Blue. This one?
Nope. No.
Blue.
That one. Okay.
Yeah.
Blue. Do you see it?
We'll get it worked out, John.
She's our strong body here that has done most of this sampling for us. Okay. Now let's see this way. Oops. Went too far. There's the map. The interesting thing about this area is that it's pretty darn well isolated. We call this area the South Central Coast, and it goes from about Point Lopez, which is right in here, to Point Conception. The area itself is part of the cold temperate zone, which moves from the subarctic all the way to Point Conception and then disappears because it intersects at that point the Southern California Bight with this warm current, the Southern California countercurrent that comes up from Mexico. And so there's a huge water temperature differential right at Point Conception. And that basically stops this area. The area north of Point Conception is full of upwelling. You saw some of that in the demonstration from Seacoast, I guess it's called.
Sencoast.
Beautiful upwelling. And this is high in nutrients and does a lot with for survival of fish and for reproduction and development. So this is an isolated area because Monterey is quite a ways to the north. Well, you can see it on this map. See if I can get it. Yeah, Monterey is right in there. And then Santa Barbara, the other port, is down here. And we've only got Morro Bay and Avila Beach as spots to launch boats. So you can monitor what's going on pretty well. You know what's going on pretty well. Okay. Purpose of the study was to review all the existing rockfish data for the South Central Coast, to extend the 1988 to 98 fish and game party boat study to the present, put together a synopsis of the conditions of rockfish assemblage in the South Central Coast, and relate this to the condition this condition to the recent historical record. Okay.
Sorry.
That's enough. What data are available? Now, it turns out there's a lot of data, but a lot of it is only marginally relevant. There was a study that began in 1977, the Triennial Bottom Trawl Surveys of the National Marine Fisheries Group. Very interesting. It's mostly quite a ways offshore for us. It's mostly soft substrate, although they use roller gear. They can go over rocks. They do this every 4 years. They did it in 1977, and then they didn't come back to it until 1995. So right now, there's 95, 98, 2001, 2004. I've been nagging them. I can't get the data from them. It's still in editing. But we will know. When we get that fourth point, it's going to look very interesting, I think. Okay. There's the PACFIN data, which started in 1981. This is commercial fisheries landings data, primarily. Almost unusable. I'll show you some of it, but they didn't really go into the catches and separate the species out. They just say, well, that's big reds and these are small reds, and so it's very difficult to deal with species on that level. But where we look at it, then the California Fish and Game party boat data. There were some early papers in the 60s and 70s, Miller and some of that group. did some excellent work, but it's hardly relevant. We can't analyze it too well with the modern data. But the 1988 to 98 data is done with the same technique we use, pretty much, with one exception. So we can use that. There were PG&E party boat studies in 1979 to 85, and that data is data we can compare with Fish and Game. So we can go from 1979 to 2004 using our data, which is pretty nice. Jay Carroll, who was one of my ex-students years ago, began a diver transect study of recruitment of rockfish in a number of areas. He works for Tenera, studying the Diablo Canyon situation, and one of his study areas is south of the plume, so it isn't affected by the warm water discharge, and that's Patton Cove. And he gave me the data from 1976 to 2003, I think, and we'll get 2004. That looks at rockfish recruitment. And then Cal Poly's recent studies that began 2003, 2004, and are going on this year. We start in about 3 days. Aaron's going out Monday, I think, we hope. And so we'll have another data. We're going out a little deeper this year, so that'll make it interesting. And John O talked about his Smurf data. So we got all kinds of data coming in here. One of the things you've got to talk about is regulation changes, because when you look at catch data, and this is catch data is pretty good. The catch you get has to do with the density of fish below you. And if you measure a standardization, the number of minutes or the number of hours that are fish, you get a standard catch per unit effort kind of. It goes from Canada to Mexico, and it's from about 30 fathoms or so to 150 fathoms, that's prime rockfish habitat. And it's being protected from trawls now. The only data we now have from trawls are from the triennial bottom trawl surveys. And we haven't got the data since they quit allowing people to work out there. But again, other things have happened. Certainly seasons have changed. They discovered when they started looking at this data that there were problems. And so they started introducing seasons, quotas, restricted or limited entry. Also, the rise of the live fish industry began in the 70s, really, and whole different kinds of trap fisheries and things were developed, gear restrictions on some of the long lines, et cetera. So there's a lot of changes that will affect what's coming in. Another thing about this is that we're dealing with environmental variabilities. And this is from Patton Cove, from Jay Carroll's data. This is the mean temperature for the era. This is from 1976 to 2003. 2004 would be another yellow bar, but a small one. The blue are below normal temperatures. The yellows basically are El Ninos. There are three of them here that you can see. The great one of 83, 84, and 85, and then one in 92 and 93, and one in 97, 98. Big El Ninos, and these have an effect on temperate fish. They don't reproduce well in them. It's very important. Temperature is an extremely important factor in the success of fish to go through their life cycle, and so these are very important. Further, in 1977, which is just after this started, we shifted climatic regimes, and we went from a PDO, which was a cool one, where the water was basically cool, and that whole mean jumped about 2 or 3 degrees. And so we're in a warm PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which ended someplace, they say. They tell me it ended around the end of the 90s, probably. And it ended earlier by some people, and some people like me, I'm not sure that it really has ended, but it's we're now supposedly in the cool period. The cool period was an excellent period for rockfish. The warm period was not an excellent period for rockfish. They didn't produce young. The young couldn't survive in warm surface temperatures. The young larvae come up to the surface and feed on the plankton in the surface. They didn't do well, and recruitment was low. And you'll see this as we go on. Okay. There should have been a slide before that. Oops. Yeah, I'm going the wrong way. Hang on. Come on. Yeah, I guess it's missing. Yeah, it seems to be missing. That's what, it was a slide showing the regions at the triennial. This is the triennial bottom trawl survey. This slide shows you the estimates of biomass for all rockfish. And this is 95, 98, and 2001. You'll notice that the mauve over here, I guess it's mauve, is the Conception area. The Conception area is this area. It goes from Point Lopez to Point Conception. And you look at it and say, oh, that's interesting. We've got rockfish, but they're not particularly abundant. But then you discover that the region we're dealing with is only a third of the region of some of these areas, and it's by far the smallest of these three regions. If you standardize it for a common area, you look over here. And all of a sudden, the mauve has become fairly important. So that we have a situation where actually the Point Conception area seems to be the richest in rockfish in these outer depths. Now, these are mostly from, well, they begin inshore at 55 fathoms, which is outside of where we could work until this year, or 55 meters, excuse me. They went out to 500 meters. So it's mostly out on the outer shelf and the slope. And a lot of these rockfish are out on the slope. There are things like thorny heads and split noses and that sort of thing. But anyway, what you see here is that our area is pretty darn rich when you standardize it. Okay. Looking at just a couple of species for the fun of it, here's the thorny heads, Sebastolobus. These are both of them together, and you'll see that in 95, our area was fairly rich, and in 98, it looks pretty bad, and you go to 2001, it's huge. So the things are not going in any direction, which is the problem with 3 points. Gophers, grass, black and yellow, and blue. And you see, basically, things look okay. They're shifting up and down. They're not going anywhere. They're not particularly directional. There is some direction here, but that direction may likely be changes in quotas that have been imposed at that point. Certainly, we see this sort of thing, and it's very difficult to follow these changes if you try and go back and check through the records. Fish and Game doesn't know what they are. I tried. So you look at this, and this looks probably like this is regulation rather than a change in abundance. Here's the Cabazon-Lincoln data, which is interesting. Cabazon here, again, fisheries change, and that makes a big difference. Here's the Lincoln data. It shows a decline. We don't really see that decline, but this is in landings, and landings depend on who's fishing for what. So there's a problem with this sort of data from that standpoint. Here's the Boccaccio data here. We know that Boccaccio have been a problem. The fishermen around here don't seem to think it is. They may be right, they may be wrong, but if you look at the real data here, which was actually identified Boccaccio, it just plunged. That's in the mid-70s. There was a lot of trawling going on for Boccaccio in this area. And there were some pretty good catches, but they died. Now, the problem was then they stopped identifying Boccaccio. They instead lumped them with chili peppers. So this graph shows chili peppers going down, the chili pepper Boccaccio line going down here, and it's also decreasing. Then they started identifying Boccaccio again, the blue line, and these are the chilies. And actually, the chilies are doing very well in this area. If you look at the chilies from the standpoint of the triennial bottom trawls, they're huge. We're getting really a lot of them. So suggests a problem there. And the Boccaccio problem is one I'm not going to gloss over. I think it's there. Here again, we're going to thorny heads because these are the offshore ones. And the thorny heads hit a peak here and have come down. But these were unidentified thorny heads. There are only two species. Then down here, they started separating the two species, so you have to pile them on top of each other. But again, it depends on whether they're fishing for them. So I don't like this data, but we have to show it to you because it's what there is. It gives us some idea of what's happening. And the landings have changed for these things. Okay. Now we're going to diver transect data. This is Jay Carroll's data. Now, this is done in about between 35 and 50 feet off Patton Cove. Patton Cove is just south of Diablo Canyon, but it's not affected by the plume, so it should be typical of what's coming in, not affected by hot water. Here are Boccaccio. It's interesting. There they are right there. There's a Boccaccio, and that's it for recruitment of Boccaccio. We don't see them. These are blues. The blues are blues. That's kind of nice. Blues are erratic. They come up and down. Gophers have done very well. If you look at the adult rockfish in that area, this is the depth of black and yellows and gophers. Gophers are very abundant, and the recruitment is pretty good on gophers. Olives have shown up strongly occasionally, the greens, the olive-colored ones. Blacks don't do particularly well. Notice a big peak here. This is the change in the Pacific decadal oscillation. Here we're in at the end of the cold regime. Here we're beginning the warm regime, and the warm regime is extending through there. And I would suggest that a lot of what we see is the effect of that change into warm water from cold water. These are the adults. Shallow transects like this they don't really give you a whole lot of information. Here we look at just the pelagic rockfish in this site. Again, Boccaccios did very well here. Then they're gone. As far as recruitment, the blues are erratic. As Jono said, some years they're good, some years they're not. This is typical of rockfish. The olives, again, some years they're good, some years they're not. So you get this movement of recruitment. But this is actual recruitment. It's not what Jono's looking at. Jono's looking at settlement. This is recruitment. This is after everything has gotten in there and eaten them. And of course, the adults are the ones that eat the most. The other thing is that the recruits aren't coming from here, probably. They're coming from up coast following the California current. So it's an interesting GNE data. They didn't give us any depths that we could follow. But if you look at this today, oops, come on. Come on. Sorry. Today, things look pretty good. I mean, if you look at this for the last, 15 years, it's as good today as it's ever been. I mean, there have been a few lumps here. Now, these lumps may be artifacts in a way, because these 2 years, they only allowed fishing they only took data in the fall. And that happens to be the biggest time for things like blues and schooling rockfish, where they get really lots of them. So that may be an artifact of that not being a full year sample. But these aren't full years either. We're stuck with what we get from Fish and Game. So there's a problem there. Another way to look at what's happened, besides the catch per unit effort, which tells you the approximate density of the fish, how many there are, is to look at how the assemblage has changed. Okay, now these are, and you can't read this, I didn't expect you to read it. I'm just putting it up to show you we got real data. Okay. These are the species along here, and they're ranked by rank order. In other words, the most abundant one is at the top, et cetera, or they're numbered. And you can see how the numbers change over this period. So sometimes, I think this was based on 87. Do you see one that just goes in order? There is one that goes in order. I think it was around 88. Okay. 88 should go 1 through 17. Now, these are the top 10 species each year, but you have to add to it because they're not always the same. Then you can test this with a rank order statistics. In this case, it's Kendall's tau. And this is the rank order statistic, which you can't read, but that's okay. What it says, there are 120 272 comparisons, year one with year two, year one with year three, etc., to see if they're similar. It tells you if it's similarly concordant. If it's concordant, if it's significantly concordant, you get a measure of significance. And if you look at all these, there were actually more than that. There were like 300. There is 272 and 65. 272 of these are similarly concordant. They really haven't changed. And in fact, you find some differences if you look way back. This is 79. These are the deeper data, or the data we have no data on from the standpoint of depth. But everything up here is all the same. The fish and game really hasn't changed. So this means that no matter how much fishing we've been doing, we haven't really changed the proportions of fish in the assemblage. That's very good. I mean, that's the kind of data that this shows us. Okay. Quickly. Okay, so now we're going to look at individual species, because this is what it's all about. This is the Baloo. This is looking at fish and game data and our data. Okay. This is the mean size of the fish. And the mean size is important because this line is the size that 50% of them are reproducing. So if you're catching them before they're reproducing, you're affecting the population. If you allow them to grow big enough to reproduce, then you can take them, and it's not going to have much of an effect on the population. Well, the blues, you're sort of fishing right on that edge. But if we look at the last 2 years, this is the take. They're looking pretty good. And they certainly haven't. You don't see any massive decline. In fact, it's been an improvement. Now, this is the catch per unit effort. Here we go. It got very high, as I mentioned, when they were fishing these late in the fall. But look at these 2 years. Very good. The present condition is, you know, hasn't changed. It's fine. Gophers, again, they're well above the 50% size, and here they are. Here are our two figures. They're just right where they should be. Nothing has happened. The catch per unit effort has actually gone up. It's as high now as it's ever been. Oops. He doesn't want to stay for me. This is vermilion. Now, vermilion looked a little bit bad. Here's the fish and game data, and it came up and was up here, and then it dropped. And if you look at our data here, it's still a little bit small. But what happened was that we've had a rather remarkable recruitment of vermilions. We were catching vermilions everywhere this year. Last year, we didn't find many. The year before that, we found relatively few vermilions. Here's the increase in catch per unit effort. The catch per unit effort for vermilions is very good. But because they're relatively new recruits, a lot of them are not very big. So we've got smaller. If you measure all of them, this is the size that we get, because we've released 90% of them. You keep about 15% of the lingcod, because they're not up at this 30-inch level they moved them to. And so we're catching loads of fish, but we had to release most of them. If we look at the kept fish, they're quite large. They're larger than the other ones because we can't keep anything the size of the others. But Fish and Game never looked at all the fish. They only measured the kept fish. So if you find a difference in that respect, we don't know what was released here. All we know is these are the ones they kept, and they were allowed to keep much smaller fish in those days. And the catch per unit effort is up, if you look at it. So the lingcod doesn't look like it's having a problem. What did I do there? Oh, well. Seemed to work. Here's a few that don't look good, but these are fish that are generally more northern and in deeper water. So this is the yellowtail and black rockfish. Black rockfish, if you go to Alaska, you catch black rockfish that you can't. I mean, you go salmon fishing and they say, keep away from the black rockfish, and they'll meter them on the bottom, and so you just don't want to catch them. Here, the yellowtail are not good. We've had good years of yellowtail back in the cool period. Back in the 70s and early 80s, we had some good yellowtail catches. In fact, they displaced blues as being the most important. But for a long time, they haven't. If you look at the fish and game data and our data, it's not all that different. It's just not good. They're small and they're rare. If you look at the actual catch per unit effort, it's point. This is the 0.2 level. That's very, very small. Black rockfish is the same. The sizes have stayed about the same and way small. The catch per unit effort has actually dropped on the blacks. We just don't see many blacks. Olives are interesting. That's a very shallow water fish. It's also a temperature tolerant fish, so it'll do well. Here's the olive data. And this is plotting 30 fathoms against 20-fathom fish. Now, there's fish that are deeper, because at the end of this last year, we were allowed to go out to 30 fathoms. This is 30-fathom stuff. And what you see here is that that yellowtail aren't found in any greater numbers when you go farther than 20 fathoms. They're mostly inshore, so you don't get any difference there. There has been a decrease, and there were huge catches of, this is what I was told, in 2002, I think, 2001, Johnny Bass were what they were catching. They were catching lots of them. Since we started doing the study, they haven't been catching lots of them. It's one of those situations. Here are the coppers. Now, this is the red is 30 fathoms, and the blue is 20 fathoms, and we catch a lot more coppers now that we're out at 30, and that's interesting. And, again, they look quite healthy. Oops. Canaries, we catch a lot more canaries. The reason we can't go out to 30 and 40 is because canaries are out there. They let us go to 30, and lo and behold, we caught a lot more canaries, the pink. Not a huge number. When we go out to 40, it's going to be interesting because canaries are a no-take fish. And what do you do with a no-take fish when you get it out of 40 fathoms? Find sea lions and feed it to it, I guess. There's not much else you can do. Here's the Boccaccio. They aren't doing well. I mean, we're getting more when we get out to 30 fathoms, but not a whole lot. And again, Boccaccio is a fish that it comes in with young a year into shallow water, but then it moves out to 100 fathoms, 200 fathoms. And that's the area of the trawl conservation zone, so we don't have a clue. Another indication here is something the Fish and Game pointed out, and we're almost done. Between near port locations and far port locations. I mean, there's a lot more fishing right around the port than in the distant locations. So one would think if you're having a problem, the near port locations would show the brunt of it, and the far port locations would show bigger fish and healthier conditions. These show the near and far locations from our studies. There's one north and one south. Here's the blue rockfish. There's no difference. I mean, there's no difference in the size. There's no difference in the catch per unit effort. Obviously, the blues are not affected by near or far, and we do fish for blues very heavily in close. Blues, of course, are a schooling fish, and they don't tend to show overfishing easily. Here's the vermilions. Now, I mentioned the vermilions earlier. The vermilions close. It's better habitat. It's really nice brown habitat down there, and what we have around here isn't nearly as good. Okay, so that's what we've looked at, and here are our conclusions. Basically, this is the important one. The data suggests that nearshore rockfish assemblage sensu lato, that means we've got the greenlings in there and lingcod, has sustained populations in the face of limited fishing pressure and unfavorable PTO. In other words, even though we've had bad conditions, they're still doing well. Few species formerly important to the assemblage are no longer so. Yellowtails and blacks, I don't know the answer to that. It may have to do with weak recruitment and warmer water, because these are fish that are better off in more northern climes. The offshore data, the packfin and the trawl data, don't indicate many obvious problems, though the Boccaccio certainly looks like a real problem. The absence of exploratory fishing in the trawl conservation area to protect the canary quota leaves a large gap in our knowledge. We don't know what's out there. We're really excited to throw Aaron out there on Monday to see what's out at 40 fathoms. We haven't been out there. 40 fathoms is relatively shallow. We'd like, as Dave said, to go deeper. But we'll take what we can get. And for the first time, we're going to get out there and see what's out in really prime habitat. We're looking at nearshore rockfish now. Boccaccio isn't a nearshore rockfish. Canary is marginally a nearshore rockfish. Coppers, canaries, and boccaccio did better at 30. And we expect to see a lot more at 40. The incipient, then we want to talk about this because we have to. Incipient implementation of the national or the nearshore fish management plan recommendation on MPAs. And everybody can see, I mean, whether you like it or not, there are going to be MPAs in this area. And I think there's a reason for them. But because of the condition of the rockfish assemblage here that we have shown you, you need to. We are beseeching, if you will, the people that are going to set up these MPAs to consider the fishing community here, because the fishing community has done fine, and our fishes are doing fine even without them. What's going to happen when you put an MPA? Well, ultimately you're going to get spillover, they say, but that's going to be a slow process. You're going to have areas where fish are sitting there, reproducing, and the young will be transported out. And some fish may swim out, but that's going to take a long, long time. And in the meantime, you're going to have more people fishing in a more limited area. So, you know, it's for a while. It may ultimately be a real boon, but right now it's going to be hard to figure. Rockfish are slow growing, slow to mature, live bearing, and not tractable for catch and release scenarios. That's the problem. I mean, if you could go out and just say, okay, we'll put a limit on size on this rockfish, you have to catch one over this size, throw it back. Well, they don't throw back. So that's why they've kept us in 20 fathoms. Now they're letting us go to 40 fathoms. We're going to be wasting a lot of fish when we get out there with this system. So you can't do some of the things that you could do with other species with rockfish. So it's a real problem. These characteristics of the rockfish make them a strong candidate for overexploitation, and we've seen that in most of California there is pretty good evidence of overexploitation. But most of them are not as isolated as we are. So we have a sort of little gem down here. MPAs are designed to harbor species from such effects and allow growth and reproduction to occur in the absence of fishing pressure, and that's what they're doing. They're supposed to allow them to get bigger. Berkeley and his group up at Santa Cruz have shown that bigger rockfish produce more competent young a year, that grow faster. And, you know, there's some real interesting connotations here, but it's only been done with blacks as far as I know. So we don't know whether it's... But the idea of MPAs is one that you think of, well, that's a hedge against bad management, which it is, and even they claim it is. Okay. However, the rockfish assemblage of the South Central Coast appears to be sustainable under current limited fishing pressure and current management protocols. So what we have here doesn't require them, but they're going to be here anyway. That's about all I have to say. Oh, that's. Oops. What happened to my thank yous? There was a thank you. Yeah. Doesn't seem to want to come up, does it?
Thank yous are down.
Yeah, I'm going down. Fishing units, party boats, and academia. And that's really cheap because we don't have to pay for the boat. When we go with other fishermen, we need to pay for their boats, but we're just two people in a party boat, and it's not that bad, or one or two people in a party boat. So this is a very easy way to get good data. You're getting data in the habitat because these captains know where to find the fish. One thing that National Marine Fisheries will tell you is that, well, you're only looking at fish in good habitat, so you don't know what's in the spaces, the interstitial spaces between. So you can't really estimate populations from this. Well, you know, this is essential fish habitat, and this is what we're talking about. And these are how the fish look where they're supposed to be. So that's important.
Yeah, I mean, could you argue that you're measuring the ability of the captains of the bonefish to target species of fish? So they've gotten better at it and chased it, they can find the last fish in the sea.
Of course, there's some of that. But most of these captains are good. I mean, some are different. They'll fish different areas. Some people like to go catch a lot of blues. Other people like to catch benthic species. So they're all different. But they all know what they're. If they don't catch fish, they're not going to be captains very long.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. They reflect the population to really reflect the ability to focus and find fish.
Yeah, that's true.
Again, I just want to say thanks very much, John, for the efforts here. And I'm. Again, we're very, very happy to see collaboration. And to make comment on the last gentleman's comment, the converse is also, you said that a captain can chase down the last fish, but when people go out there who don't know where to look for the fish, and they come up with some bad data, it's because they didn't know where to look. So to get good data, you have to go to someone who knows where to look. Fish don't just species looking for a species specific area. You have to go to a specific area.
This is the argument that that fishermen have used against the triennial bottom trawl thing, which is a random quadrat system. They have so many trawls at each depth in each area. Well, they're covering the whole area, and sometimes they don't catch anything, sometimes they do. So they're you know, this will balance out in estimating the population size. That's a good way of doing it. We don't get those estimates, but we're looking at what is there, and we know there are fish there when we see it. Dave?
Yeah, to answer his question, we don't fish the same spots all the time. We fish different depths. Now we can fish even a larger depth of fish, and they don't always bite the same places at the same time. There's a whole lot of conditions that go on to where there can be fish there, and there can bite. For instance, the 3x3 off of Point Bichon, it's so sensitive to the current that everything can look beautiful and the fish will be down there. They don't bite. And there's tons of fish. So if you ever got out there and looked at a meter and looked where we're at, probably wouldn't ask that question truthfully.
So I'm saying the same question.
Because we don't go out to catch the last fish and see, because they're on the rocks. We know where they're at, but there's so many rocks. I mean, it's infinite the amount of fish are out there.
Other questions? So this is ongoing work. You have more analyses, things that you're doing.
We're pretty happy with where this is. I have a manuscript pretty well done. It's just too big. I mean, I have to cut it way down. But we're about ready. I've been through all the authors have participated in reviewing the manuscript. We're pretty happy with it at this point. But we're going to keep going. And this is an infinite data set as far as we're concerned. As long as we can get students to go out there, as long as we have funding to cover this, as long as Dean works hard, we'll keep it up, because I think a data set should at least be 10 years.
So you have two and eight to go, huh?
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do on.
So I think Jim had his hand up first, and Jono, and then Mel. And we do have two other brief items to cover, so we want to give a.
This will be quick. You said you had some holes in your data, and the reason was you weren't allowed to go out there in the trawl areas or beyond 40 fathoms. You finally. How many studies do you have to do in a no study zone to come up with real data, and why? What would it take to allow a collaborative fishing effort to go into these black holes to get real data? Is it a law?
Very nice sample, you know, doing transects with submersibles up and down in the cow cod areas. And they came back with a lot more cow cod than the estimate should be there. So they got out there and they got to do it. But they were doing a non-invasive sampling. They were just looking and counting. That could be done, but, you know, submersibles are very expensive. But he did it, and his data showed there were a lot more cow cod out there than were expected. He's having trouble getting it published from National Marine Fisheries. And isn't that interesting?
So, John,
did you have something further?
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I don't think that this group realizes that the entire state of California is very focused in on this project and very interested in it. John and I and Bob Mallett flew to meet with the director of Fish and Game in Sacramento, Brian Broderick. They first wanted to see and know about the report before they committed anything, but we talked with the head biologist of the Fish and Game, who runs the SURFS program for all of California, as well as Brian Broderick and the head of the Marine Region. And Fish and Game is very interested in exporting this same protocol model for use statewide in California along the coast. NOAA is also interested, although they use a different technique most of the time. They do more of your regular fish stock recruitment type surveys, but they're very interested in implementing this same project statewide to gather fishery data. We're contemplating the possibility of exporting this idea by using universities all along the coastal part of the state, their graduate students in the marine biology departments. We already have approached the various party boat operators from the Oregon border to the Mexican border, and they're agreeable to the onboard survey being in their communities. And we feel that we're going to gather data. It's going to take a long time because we don't have baseline data for Southern California. We have it all the way to the Oregon border, but we don't have it in Southern California. But I think that over the next decade, this project that you guys started here on the MIG group may be the most influential data gathering tool in the state of California. So you guys deserve a pat on the back. I mean, this is a fantastic, fantastic program, I think.
Thank you. Any other comments?
John Stevens deserves a big hand.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
John.
Oh, Marla.
I just had one, question or comment for John and Dean. Not being a scientist, and I agree with Mel, it is very impressive what the collaborative has done. But if you might take a moment and revisit the conclusions, it seemed to me that there might be some combination of conclusions of the science combined with some opinions. I'd like to just, I don't want a discussion, I don't think we have time. I need to get home. But I wanted to say that. A revisit of the conclusion to look at the science and the opinions there.
All right. Well, just a couple of final items here. And let's see, I need to. Okay. What I want to do is just cover very briefly. As you know, for the past several months, the Marine Interest Group has been working on this ecosystem-based management endeavor. And there's a number of people, Bob Hather, Pam Hetherington, Leslie Krentz, Rick Algard, who was here earlier. Anyone else that I'm missing?
From the MAC.
From the MAC. Dan Berman, of course, and Dean Wendt. And then a number of people from the National Estuary Program that have been working on that issue to see what's the connection between the watershed and the near shore marine environment, and how can that be enhanced and work more effectively. How can these agencies, this group has always been talking about the frustrations of the lack of coordination and integration of the different agencies to mutual benefit, and how can that be enhanced? So that proposal effort's going forward, and Dean, do you want to take just a minute or two, because we then need to go very quickly to a discussion about topics for the next meeting. And
State Parks, Coastal Commission, all of the people who have an interest in that Morro Bay area, and they've identified these six areas in which we're asking a series of more sort of, I wouldn't call them specific, but general questions, things like water quality, for instance, what are the freshwater sources to the watershed, and how do the volume, quality, and seasonality and other characteristics of these sources affect the bay and estuary? And we can go down, and I could do this, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to give you a quick update. These are the areas that we've outlined. We've developed questions, embedded a series of questions, and the science team is now taking these questions and beginning to more specifically develop the kinds of projects that we could actually begin to propose. And really, I guess the way to think about this ecosystem-based management is to really think about it as an extension of what we're already doing. And we're doing a lot of work. We're starting some pilot work with water quality and birds. But and most of what we've done is fisheries sorts of stock assessments. And so what we want to do with this is expand to really look at the entire ecosystem more fully and in more depth. So move beyond just our fisheries work, continue that, but then to start to look even broader than that and do it in the sort of context and the framework that we've been doing our previous research, which is involving stakeholders, trying to connect our science to the relevant resource agencies, and trying to make the same sort of progress in a variety of different areas. But these are the areas that are driving the work that we're going to be doing. And I don't know if Don or Dan's gone, but Don, if you have anything else to add to that, or if you'd like me to show something more, but in the interest of time, I think we're probably okay.
I just wanted to be sure this group had the update and knew how this was progressing. And if you've got more interest and questions, you know, catch up with Dean afterwards. He's taking the lead on it. Dan Berman and I are also working on the organization of this effort, and we do have the advisory committee with representation from this group actively working on that. That proposal is going to go in June 30th. And so that's the basic.
So here's the outline. We have an advisory committee next week, science team meeting on the 23rd of May to really develop the projects more specifically, another advisory committee meeting on the 6th, and then this finished proposal is by the 30th to the Packard Foundation.
So the next topic before we conclude is just what are the topics that the group would like to have discussed at the next meeting, and then we need to have some understanding about what the time frame would be for the next meeting. From the things that I've heard, I don't hear, you know, we've basically been trying to be on a quarterly meeting system. I'm thinking that maybe the next meeting might be in the September time frame, just because so much effort's getting focused in on getting this proposal and other things done by the end of June. But would like to hear from the members if there are topics that you'd like to have included at that time, or there are pressing topics that you'd like to be sure get covered, such that we'd need to have a meeting, you know, before the summer starts or during the summer.
I'd like to talk about funding at the next meeting so we don't get caught short all of a sudden, especially if we have the meeting before Dean's proposal is due, if there's anything particularly updating, volunteer time, other contributions that are helpful to your request. That's the main topic I would like to see at the next meeting.
Okay, so funding sources and things of that nature. We also have to factor in, Dean, you know, when the Resources Legacy Foundation Fund funding concludes. It's been funding all the collaborative research this year, and when you need to get some factoring in on that. Do you have a sense of that time frame?
Well, the current funding is through the end of the calendar year. It hasn't increased, but we extended the time frame given the way some of the projects were proceeding.
Okay.
So I would have to talk I don't know if there's some mechanism for us to get updated funding before the current contract is ended. I haven't talked to them.
Okay, so that's an item to check into. Let's just quickly check on any other topics that people would like to have. PJ?
I would like to see the rest of the presentation that you had for today on the ecosystem-based management.
You mean now or?
No, when I'm away.
Well, we can either have another meeting, which might be either something like, I think the dates that were possibly cropping up would be May 26th or June 2nd. Those would be Thursdays. Or the outline that Dean real time and wouldn't really, by the time we have the next meeting, if we do before the proposal goes in, the scientists and everyone else will be having done so much work that there won't be adequate opportunity to really consider your thoughts.
Yeah, in terms of the pertinence of the study to what the Marine Interest Group is about, I'd like to have the opportunity to go over the outline and what we've accomplished this last winter.
Okay. Any other topics that are of interest to people? So I think the key question would be, I think on the funding topic, other than getting the Packard grant implementation grant application in, I'm not hearing that the funding thing would need to be hit before September, would it? The Resource Legacy Fund and other sources that you're looking at?
Those are the only two I'm looking at.
Right. But, I mean, I don't hear anything from their cycle that would mean that you need to have a meeting before,
no.
In answer to Marla's question, a meeting before September in order to address that, do you?
I don't see that either.
So then really the question becomes what level of interest and involvement the members wish to have and how much discussion about the ecosystem-based management proposal and whether that's something that there's a strong interest to do in advance of its June 30 submission or you want us to keep you up to date via email and get comments back. What would be the what would be your druthers? I think there's a sense from the people who are working most intimately on this that if a meeting isn't needed, they want to keep their nose to the grindstone and grind the, do the work that's needed to get this done. But if the group has a strong interest and wants to be more involved in that, then we need to know that and factor that in and work that through. Do you what are perspectives? Pardon me? So we'll give you some email updates and keep you tracking on that and ask people that have a strong interest. And you'll be welcome to join in on one of these advisory committee meetings if you want to be more active if you're not one of the participants in that, representatives from this group in that, but would like to be involved. So maybe that would be a good way to do it, and that way people could factor out their own level of interest and commitment. So what we'd be targeting then under this scenario is that we'd be communicating with you by email about updates on the ecosystem-based management program. Maybe there's, Henry, there's something that you can provide that we could also share on an email format until it looks like we'd be coming back in September to have a meeting of this group and carry through on the funding issues and other updates and developments and further things to enhance the success of this group. Does that sound like a plan? Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you,
scientists, for all your great work.
Thanks, Don, for your presentation.
Don, did we get the actual date in September we're going to be meeting?
We're going to have to come back to you with dates. It's going to depend upon availability of rooms and other things.
Okay.